It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
Hey, Rick Derringer died on Memorial Day. 77 years old. How appropriate for a guy who wrote the song Real American to die on Memorial Day. He co-wrote Real American for the wrestling album. His writing partner, Bernard Kenny, he's the one that you actually hear on the lead vocals, not Derringer. And Cyndi Lauper provides backup vocals on the song, which is something I did not even realize about until maybe a month ago. But it was never intended for Hulk Hogan. It was actually meant to be used by Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda when they tagged as the U.S. Express. Then they left the company and they gave the song to Hogan since it fit well with his gimmick. He was the all-American hero and the song became legendary. But for my money, it's the greatest wrestling entrance song of all time. And you will never convince me otherwise. And Derringer is also responsible for Demolition's theme song, which according to this Yahoo News story here, that I'm looking at was Hogan's other theme. Boy, they just let anybody write for these websites now, don't they? Real American and Demolition, two of the greatest themes ever made. They don't make them like that anymore. This is episode 915 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 1st, 2025. I am the Solo Monster. The Knicks lost to the Pacers last night, so their season is done. And that means Michael Cole lost that stupid bet to Pat McAfee. So now he's got to wear a tank top all night tomorrow. So hide the women and children. You know, they're actually selling a t-shirt on WWE Shop with a cartoon image of Tyrese Halliburton doing the choking gesture from Game 1. The clout chasing here is real. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the top of the page. $10 or more, we'll get you a nickname and a shout-out here. Let's go through roll call with Big B, Brian Becerra, thank you. Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, oh my God. M. Mills, thank you very much. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Portland Pop Star, Paul Hamilton. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. Best in the Game, Trey Porter. And Killshot Keith Hart. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it. House of Glory presents Mike Santana's Puerto Rican Weekend this coming Saturday, June 7th at the NYC Arena. Start time 6:30 p.m. Tickets are available at hogwrestling.net. It'll be Puerto Rico versus the world when Mike Santana, who just appeared on NXT television this week, defends his HOG World Championship against the Stone Pitbull, Tomohiro Ishii. The Amazing Red returns for the first time in months. WWE ID prospect Marcus Mathers is going to be making his HOG debut, as does Danny Limelight and Carissa Rivera, the former Electra Lopez from WWE and Legado del Fantasma. She's going to be making her House of Glory debut for Puerto Rican Weekend, taking on Deonna Purrazzo from AEW, even though you really never get to see her in AEW. But she's there, and she'll be here in New York City this coming Saturday. So hopefully I get to see some of you guys there, because that's where I'll be. And if you can't be there in person, you can stream the event live on Triller TV Plus if you're not tuned into Money in the Bank. We got to start with this. This was kind of out of nowhere this week, but feels kind of like a big deal. There's a major update this week in the Vince McMahon sex trafficking lawsuit as his co-defendant, John Laurinaitis,
People Power,
has now agreed to cooperate and provide evidence to Janelle Grant and her team in her bombshell lawsuit against McMahon, Laurinaitis, and WWE. Laurinaitis has also reached a confidential settlement with Grant. This is according to a statement issued by both of their reps on Wednesday. Per CNBC, A filing Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Connecticut shows that lawyers for Grant and Laurinaitis agreed to dismiss her lawsuit as it pertains to Laurinaitis only, with prejudice, which means that it cannot be refiled. John Laurinaitis has agreed to cooperate and provide evidence in Janelle Grant's lawsuit against Vince McMahon and WWE, the rep said in a statement. His agreement to a confidential settlement is a pivotal next step toward holding McMahon and WWE accountable and bringing justice to Ms. Grant after years of sexual abuse and trafficking. Mr. Laurinaitis looks forward to moving on with his life. We cannot provide any additional details at this time. Jessica Rosenberg, who is a lawyer for Vince McMahon, in a statement to CNBC said, "Today's dismissal of John Laurinaitis as a defendant does not alter the facts of this case in any way. Vince McMahon never mistreated Janelle Grant. No matter how many press releases her team issues, the truth remains unchanged." As Mr. Laurinaitis' lawyer previously said, Mr. Laurinaitis corroborates Mr. McMahon in publicly declaring that Ms. Grant's allegations of sexual abuse and coercion in her complaint are completely unfounded. Grant's lawsuit against McMahon and WWE alleges that McMahon lured her with promises of career advancement, and then allegedly exploited and trafficked her to other men inside the company. Grant signed a non-disclosure agreement in 2022 with McMahon, agreeing to a payment of $3 million to not publicly disparage him or discuss their relationship. She alleges in the suit that he stopped making payments after the first $1 million of that was received. Her lawsuit is seeking to void the NDA and additional financial damages. The case is currently awaiting a ruling on whether it will be sent to private arbitration. Lawyers for the defendants have until June 13th to refile their motion to compel arbitration. Grant's team will have until June 23rd to respond, and a decision will be made after that. Earlier this month, a federal judge granted Grant's request to file an amended complaint to include information regarding WWE's settlement with the SEC over undisclosed payments, expanded allegations of abuse, the naming of alleged enablers, and efforts to obtain medical records from a doctor that she alleges was paid by McMahon. So this makes the second time that he has switched sides in this case. When the suit was first filed, remember, Laurinaitis' attorney at the time said that he was also a victim of Vince McMahon. He basically threw Vince under the Lex Express. And he said at the time, he's like the plaintiff, you know, Laurinaitis is also a victim in this case. Read the allegations and count how many times in the complaint McMahon exerts control over them. You know, Johnny Boy is a victim too. But then 3 months later, Laurinaitis changed his tune and said that he supported McMahon and that he would fight right alongside him, and her allegations were baseless. So now he's flipped again to the other side of the track. He better be able to provide some solid evidence for whatever they're looking for, because this guy has flipped more times than a burger on July 4th. I wouldn't find him to be the most credible witness in the world, because he'll say whatever he has to just to save his own skin. But they obviously feel he has something, or he knows something that could be helpful to their case. Now, why this happened now, before the judge made her ruling on whether the case should go to trial or arbitration, I don't know. If it went to arbitration, it would be focused on how much money she is owed by Vince, you know, based on the NDA that she signed. And if he, you know, should be on the hook for the remaining $2 million that he owes her. That wouldn't have anything to do with Johnny Ace. And that ruling is expected to come down very soon. So he could have, you know, he could have ended up going the same route then, but he chose to do so now, which I find kind of interesting. So she gets a confidential settlement out of it with him. As far as Vince, it all comes down to what the judge decides. You know, if it goes to arbitration, that may not work out well for her. She wants it to go to court and to go through discovery, and I just can't see Vince not making her an offer to settle this and just make all of this go away. You know, he paid off Rita Chatterton, and how many years later was it, you know, since that alleged incident where she claimed that, you know, he raped her in the back of his limousine. And that, I mean, she's had that story for years and years. That was a known thing. And then a few years ago, he finally paid her off to make her go away, because I think at the time he was trying to get back into WWE. Let's make all this go away. I think that, you know, you're looking at a similar situation here. I think in the end, she settles for a few million dollars and is barred from saying anything negative about Vince. You know, I know some people are clamoring for this to go to trial and for whatever else, you know, there may be to come out publicly. But remember, this is a civil case. This is not a criminal case. Vince McMahon is not going to prison. At worst, he's going to end up owing this woman a great deal of money. He'll do whatever he needs to do to spare himself any further embarrassment. And this woman is going to get on with her life because the only reason she came forward with this in the first place was because he stopped paying her. Now, that doesn't mean that all of these other things didn't happen to her. It's awful. But it just means that if he would have stuck to the terms that they agreed to, we would not be talking about this right now. And Vince McMahon would very likely still be running WWE. Yeah, the money is what led us to this point. I don't see him offering to settle for millions more than what she was owed and her turning that down. Again, it's civil. It's not criminal. Vince knows he can make this go away if push comes to shove, and that's what I expect is going to end up happening here. At which point, we'll hear more about what his plans are for the future and this new company that he started. I think they're just waiting for this to be settled. But on that note, Brandon Thurston of WrestleNomics this week reported that McMahon has launched a new business venture, forming a private investment firm called 14th and I, the letter I, pursuing opportunities in sports, media, and entertainment. In public filings show McMahon registered three LLCs in September of last year for 14th and I Holdings, LLC, 14th and I Investments, LLC, and 14th and I Management, LLC. And Brad Blum, a former WWE executive and longtime ally of McMahon, is the president of 14th and I. The name of the firm is a reference to where his father's Old Capital Wrestling Corporation headquarters used to be located, at the corner of 14th and I in Washington, D.C. And there's something else involving Vince that was floating around this week that I wanted to address because it's just so ridiculous. There was a tweet from Chris Featherstone of Sportskeeda where he said, "I was given word from a source close to the situation that Vince McMahon is interested in buying back WWE. I receive more details, but we will see how this develops." Ah, yes. So, of course, people made a mountain out of a molehill with this. Oh, I'm sure Vince McMahon is very interested in buying back WWE. Tony Khan may be interested in buying WWE. Doesn't mean he's got a prayer of actually doing it. But by God, he may be interested. But he tweets this out knowing that people are going to run with it and make more out of it than there is because that's what social media does. So technically, you see, he's not wrong. Look, Vince McMahon is not buying back WWE. Then you have Jonathan Coachman, who spoke recently about the potential for Vince to return to the company. This may well have been where Featherstone got his info, for all we know, because his tweet came days after Coachman apparently talked about this. But Coachman had a post on social media clarifying that he never actually said that Vince was trying to buy back WWE, only that he has shown interest in buying back WWE under the right circumstances. If things went back for, let's say things went downhill for TKO in the next 5 years, and WWE became available, he said, then Vince would be interested in buying it back. The fucking mosquito that I squashed this morning could have told you that. Yes, of course, under the right circumstances, if WWE became available for purchase, I think Vince McMahon, the man who ran the company for 40 years, might just be interested in making an offer. This is not news. And you shouldn't treat it as news, because there was no actual news that he or any of these people actually reported. So we'll clear this up real fast. For the handful of emails I got about this week, no, Vince McMahon is not buying back WWE. Endeavor, TKO, what have you, is not selling WWE. Nor is Vince McMahon coming back to WWE. And if anybody else is trying to peddle this nonsense to you as actual news, then those are people that you should not be following. And as I am sitting here recording this, I am getting a text message with some breaking news. Let me check this out here and see if this is legit. This is like what happened with the Sabu show a few weeks ago. Oh, let me see here. Let's see. Ron Killings, R-Truth on Twitter. Yep, there it is. Wow. All right, well, we got some breaking news here during the sound off. Ron Killings just tweeted the following. I'm sorry to inform you all, I just got released from WWE. I want to thank WWE for the ride, but mostly I want to thank each and every one of you who was along for the ride. Thank you for all the love, support, and appreciation you have given me over the years. Thank you. That's pretty shocking. Honestly, I did not see that coming. Let me see here if there's any other information about this. All right, this is Mike Johnson on PW Insider. PW Insider has been told that Truth's tweet is accurate in that his current WWE deal will not be renewed and he is exiting. Okay, and I'm seeing Sean Ross Sapp say the same thing. So the way Truth phrased it here makes it sound like he just got released and he's gone. But based on what these other sites are saying, he has been given word, I guess, that his contract will not be renewed. So that's like what happened with Sonya Deville, where she wasn't outright released right away, but she was told that her contract, it was coming up and it just wasn't going to be renewed. So it sounds like that's the case with R-Truth, but wow. You know, he's someone, when I think of that WWE roster and anybody who left who would be like a lifer, it would be him. You know, and I remember the stories about Vince McMahon being a big fan of his and wanting to keep him around and have him on the roster because he made him laugh and he found him very funny and entertaining. But, you know, look, I mean, this is the TKO era, man. Everybody is just a statistic. You know, I mean, that's really what it boils down to here. How old is Truth, man? Is he 51 or 50? Let me see here. Let me see. R-Truth is, 53 years old. He don't look it. He don't look it, but he's 53 years old. So look, I mean, he came back to WWE. It had to be around 2007 or 2008. It was somewhere in the early years when I started doing this show is when he came back and started his second run with WWE because he was there originally as far back as the Attitude Era. Like when they brought him in, he was very young and he was doing the tag team thing with Road Dogg. This is back when he was K-Quick. And yeah, I mean, that was probably 99, 2000. I mean, is Truth the last of the Attitude Era guys that were on that roster? He may be. I'm just trying to think. I mean, he may be. It was Jericho, but Jericho left a number of years ago. I mean, who else is left that was active from that Attitude Era period, right? Undertaker's is done. Jericho's been gone for a while from the company. It had to be Truth. I mean, it feels like the end of an era here. I'm kind of just knocked back on my heels here. I wasn't expecting this. But yeah, I mean, he came back around 07 or 08, so he has had a run of almost 20 straight years in this company, which is a pretty damn good run if it has to come to an end. But, you know, he just was in the ring with John Cena on Saturday night's main event. You know, now that I think about this, I wonder if that was done that way on purpose because they had some sense, maybe he didn't, but maybe they had some sense that this was coming. Maybe this was their way of giving him that one last big match, you know, before they let him go. I don't know. I mean, technically his last match was on Friday. He did a squash match. He lost to JC Mateo. So they had him do the honors for the new guy on the way out. But yeah, I would be very curious if Truth had any sort of heads up on this or when the company made this decision, how late in the game they made this decision, because I mean, just thinking about it in wrestling terms, like you had this big match with John Cena on Saturday night's main event. How do you not have like a career stipulation? Like that would have made the match mean so much more and put so much more heat on Cena. If Cena was the guy to retire R-Truth, who everybody loves, this beloved figure on the show, and Cena has said, I'm going to ruin wrestling, and for him to ruin wrestling by getting rid of R-Truth. Like, that's what makes me think, like, when did they make this decision? Because if this decision was made weeks ago, I don't know why they didn't add a stipulation like that to the match. But, look, this is all breaking right now. This is all we know. Let me see here. Road Dogg apparently tweeted something. Again, Road Dogg and R-Truth were very close. They were tag team partners early in Truth's run there. All right, so the tweet is gone. So Evidently, he was either told to take it down or he thought better of it and maybe shouldn't have tweeted what he did. But I have it here because, of course, when you tweet something, it lives forever. But Road Dogg is the senior VP was it live events or create? I know he's one of the co-head writers on SmackDown. Anyway, Road Dogg, Brian James, this is what he posted before he took it down. I am heartbroken. It's the nature of the beast, the part of the business that nobody likes but the bean counters. I love Ron the Truth Killings, and I don't care who knows it. What a run. Well, evidently he does care, or else he would have kept the tweet up. But anyway, that was Road Dogg, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of tweets and a lot of, you know, tributes from his colleagues that are pouring in. I mean, he was beloved, not only by fans, but by the people he worked with. Like, you will not hear a bad word said about R-Truth from anybody in WWE that has worked with him, that has been around him. He was just one of those beloved figures, which, again, makes it harder to understand what the idea was here, other than he was, I'm sure, making a lot of money, and maybe they just felt like he was making more money than they cared to pay him, you know, for what they did with him. It could come down to just simple economics here. He was 53 years old, although he was still active. It's not like he's, you know, not able to work. You know, he can still get in the ring and do most of the stuff that he has always done, but it could just come down to that. I'm sure he had a very nice contract, and maybe they just felt like they didn't want to pay him anymore. I don't know. I mean, if his contract was coming up and it's a matter of it ending and them not renewing it, were they negotiating a new deal? You know, WWE very often will start conversations with people months in advance about signing a new contract. That's why we have an incomplete picture of what's going on here. So as more details come out or on the show next week, I'm sure I'll talk more about it. But I'd be curious to know how far in advance both parties knew about this, if they were already in active discussions, if it comes down to money, you know, and what the situation is. But that's a big loss. That is a big loss. Maybe it's not a big loss in terms of, you know, on-air storylines, but clearly it's going to be a big loss for the people who work with him in that locker room. Because he has been there forever. And he's also somebody who I think was very versatile in that he could play multiple roles. He could be a serious guy. He could be a comedy character, which is really how WWE used him for most of his run. You know, when he came back, and again, it's been 17 or 18 years, the majority of that run, he was used for comic relief on these shows. But there was that one brief period of time where he turned heel and they paired him up with Miz. And they used them against Rock and Cena when Rock came back to the company at Survivor Series in 2011. But that was really one of the only times that you can really remember him being used in a role like that. You know, people still to this day talk about when they turned him heel and he was smoking a cigarette on Raw, and they long for the days like, bring back that R-Truth. Like, can we get that guy back for one angle? But, you know, they had a role for him that they felt like, okay, this is the best use of him. And the kids loved R-Truth. A lot of people did, not just kids. It does get old after a while, though. I do feel like there were a number of years there where he could have been used to do more than what they had him doing. And it was just sort of like, well, this is his role and that's the way it is. It's like, well, it doesn't have to be that way. You could do other things with him. But they just, you know, they elected not to. Now, he got his WrestleMania moment last year in that ladder match where he and Miz won. So for him, that was a cool moment, but that's really all it was. It was a moment. It was like, all right, now we got to get the belts off of them and onto some more serious teams. And then it was just right back to doing the same stuff that they always had him doing. But I always felt like when it was time for him to wind things down, and I talked about this on the podcast, I even pitched a whole idea for it. Like when the time came that Truth felt like, you know what, I think I'm going to call it a day. Not that he should have gotten a retirement year like John Cena is getting now, because John Cena is, you know, one of the biggest stars in the history of the company. But I still feel like there was a story there that they could have and should have told with him trying to get one last serious run at that world championship, whichever world championship it was, world title, WWE title, it doesn't matter. But I think there was an opportunity to do something a little more serious with him at the very end of his career, get the people behind him and... But they didn't see it that way. Well, either that or he just wasn't ready to hang it up yet. Obviously, they made the decision for him, it sounds like. So, but it was just a story I feel like they could have done at some point, and now You know, we're not going to be able to get it. And I don't know what his goals are outside of WWE. Again, he's 53 years old. Does he want to continue wrestling and just doing indies? Does he want to sign a contract somewhere and have more stability, you know, that way? He could make a killing. I mean, no pun intended, but I mean, killings can make a killing just making appearances if that's really all he ever wanted to do, and just do conventions and signings and things of that nature. He can come out with a podcast like everybody else does. You know, he's a very entertaining guy. He's a talented musician. So sky's still the limit for him. You know, whatever he wants to do, there'll be definite interest there from a lot of different people. But again, he was one of those guys who I thought would be there until the wheels fell off, and he made the call himself that he wanted to scale back or wind things down. But he had a very long run there, and always put smiles on people's faces, either on camera or off camera. So a big loss, a big surprise announcement here, breaking as I am recording this, that R-Truth is on his way out of WWE, and it doesn't sound like that was his choice. So that is what we know so far on that. I watched NXT Battleground last weekend. Not live, I was watching Double or Nothing, but I watched Battleground the next day. I thought it was a very good show. Not as strong as Double or Nothing, but it was still very good. Sol Ruka and Kalani Jordan, they had a good one for the Women's North American Championship. The Soul Snatcher is one of the coolest moves in wrestling. Even though, you know, sometimes her opponent has to lean their head in to take it, and it just looks overly choreographed. But it's still a great visual. Stephanie Vaquer and Jordan Grace, they had an excellent match. I was somewhat surprised to see Stephanie retain, but less so given the news that came later in the week, which we'll talk about. And Trick Williams, as I predicted last week, makes history by becoming the first ever WWE contracted talent to win the TNA World Heavyweight title. And it looks like my prediction for Slammiversary last week is looking pretty good right now, because it's been very clear to me, and I'm sure at least some of you guys, that Mike Santana was the next one there to be anointed. They've been building him and building him and building him up for months. He had that feud, you know, not long ago with Mustafa Ali. It just seemed logical that this was the eventual direction that they were going in. The only question was, would they want him to be the one to take it off Joe Hendry? Or would it make more sense to have Hendry drop it to a heel and then have Santana win it off that person? That, to me, makes more sense. And this felt like the time to do it, with Slammiversary coming to New York City next month. They're going to be running the UBS Arena. That's going to be a big show. Have Trick win the title now. Give him a short run with it. Let him split his time between NXT and TNA. And build to Santana as the hero who brings the belt back home in his hometown. But if they're going to do it, by the way, there's a lot of similarities there, aren't there, to All In. I'm not saying that there's any direct connection here. I'm just, in my head, I just, in saying that, I'm just thinking of Hangman, you know, the cowboy riding into Texas, trying to be the savior for AEW against the Death Riders. But, you know, in this case, it's kind of a similar deal, and you have Santana win the championship. If they're going to do it, it's not going to be their first match, though, because this Tuesday on NXT, Mike Santana will be challenging Trick Williams for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. So Santana made his debut in the ring this past Tuesday in a match against Tavion Heights of the No Quarter Catch crew. They had a real good match. Santana won. And then Santana came back out again later in the show to confront Trick in the ring, and he cut a great promo on him before Santino Marella, who is the director of authority for TNA, popped up on the big screen and made the match official for this Tuesday. It was quite the night on Tuesday for the reigning House of Glory world champion. He may be rolling into New York City next Saturday with two titles instead of one. But I don't expect that to happen, realistically. It would be cool if it did, but there's no way they do a title change this week. This is just match one. You know, all roads should lead to Slammiversary. But, you know, seeing Santana out there at the PC, he looked like he belonged. You know, he looked like a star. He's ready for that spot. He's been ready for that spot. He's been waiting a long time for this. And it was very cool to see him inside the ring there getting the kind of reception that he did. That was the show that was supposed to be held at the Yuengling Center in Tampa, but they only sold 1,700 tickets in a building that fits 10,000. So they moved it to the Performance Center. You could tell they wanted that show in a bigger building just based on all the crazy shit that happened on that show on Tuesday. Ricky Saints lost his NXT North American Championship to Ethan Page. That's how they opened the show. And they closed the show with Stephanie Vaquer losing her NXT Women's Championship to Jacy Jayne.
Jacy Jayne?
Yes, Jacy Jayne. That Jacy Jayne. A fatal influence. To say that was shocking would be the understatement of the year.
Wait, Jacy Jayne?
Yes, Jacy Jayne. Now keep quiet. Mike Rome was so stunned, he had to be reminded to announce Jacy as the winner. They had this guy sitting next to him, one of the production assistants, like, poke him and say, hey, you got to announce the winner. In the PC, like, you could hear this, like, awkward, shocked silence from the crowd after the three count. They couldn't believe what they just saw. And with Stephanie getting called up to Raw, the title coming off of her had to happen, but you would think it would have gone to Jordynne Grace at Battleground, but the plan is said to be for Jordynne Grace to go to SmackDown, where Julia is. Right now, I looked. I mean, Jordynne Grace's profile is not on the NXT roster page anymore, but I couldn't find it on the SmackDown page either. So maybe they were in the process of updating things, but she's not listed anywhere. And look, I don't even hate the idea of shocking people. It's good to get people talking every now and then and make things feel a little more unpredictable. I wish Triple H would have the balls to do that more often on the main roster. You know, one of the things that Shawn Michaels, for example, is not afraid to do, and sometimes it's out of necessity because of call-ups, but he's not afraid of bouncing the belts around. Now, I'm not saying they should hot potato the titles, you know, all around all the time, but, you know, look at what he's done with NXT. Julia had the title for 63 days. Stephanie had the title for 77 days. The North American title, Dragon Lee, 31 days. Shawn Spears, 28 days. Ricky Saints, 56 days. But Jacy Jayne is just such a curious choice, especially when you've got Jada Parker, who's been in the title mix, right? She challenged Stephanie for the title back in March. She was part of that Fatal 4-Way at Stand and Deliver. You've got Fallon Henley, another member of Fatal Influence, who's already been North American champion before. She and Jacy have been beefing lately. They haven't been on the same page. Fallon, I could see. But Jacy Jayne, it's as random a title change as I've seen in years, and it screams transitional champion to me. But if Jordynne Grace is leaving, then who does the title go to next? Sol Ruka is already the North American champion. Zarya is there, but they've had her hanging with Sol, and that's probably a North American title match down the road. There's Jada. There's Lash Legend, who's noticeably improved. They got rid of Jakara Jackson. They kept Lash. They have high hopes for her, or she wouldn't be there. But there's another name, and I'll mention this here because I think it's directly relevant. Mariah May is gone from AEW. She appears to be headed to WWE. Not that this is really much of a surprise. This was talked about several weeks ago, and then things went quiet, and there was some talk about, well, maybe she's not going to leave. Maybe she'll stay. Maybe she'll even appear at Double or Nothing, which never happened. But per PW Insider, Mariah May was removed from the AEW website this week, which usually means that somebody has departed the company and is free and clear to go elsewhere. We can confirm that we have heard from WWE sources over the last week that she is expected to start there in the near future. And per Fightful Select, even though AEW has removed her from their roster, May's management claimed via Fightful Select her deal is still active, but reports from WWE sources indicate that her move to the company is all but confirmed. However, WWE is preparing for her arrival once her AEW contract concludes, with WWE already expressing strong interest in signing her. Oh, I'll bet. So there seems to be some debate about whether or not she's officially a free agent, or she will be in a matter of weeks, or even months. That we don't know. I did notice her merch has already been removed from the Shop AEW website, so whatever t-shirts there were before are no longer available. And look, if she comes to WWE, which I'm sure she will, she would become only the second former AEW world champion to jump to WWE after CM Punk. You know, the Hollywood ending, really, when you think back now to Revolution, the Hollywood ending really was the perfect send-off for her, like to what was the perfect run. She came into the company to be part of what would go on to become the biggest women's storyline that they've ever done. And honestly, one of the best stories, period, that they've ever done. She won their world title at Wembley in front of 50,000 people in her hometown. And she dropped it back to her, her being Toni Storm, in one of the best women's matches in company history to climax their story. Right down to them showing the words, "the end," on the big screen when it was over. We didn't know just how true that statement was for Mariah May. You know, she didn't overstay her welcome. Her actual title run was very forgettable. I wish they would have given her more to do there, but I don't know how you could argue the rest of it. But it's always been her dream to go to WWE. And look, if she had her heart set on that, I said this when the rumors first popped up, you know, if her heart was set on going to WWE, then there wasn't much Tony Khan was going to be able to do about it, no matter how much money he threw at her. I'm sure he wanted to keep her. I'm sure he made her a very lucrative offer, a very nice offer. But the heart wants what the heart wants, and sometimes that's just not enough. But beyond Toni Storm and Mercedes Moné, the AEW women's division, you know, it's not like it'll be a blow losing Mariah because she was, you know, a good part of that division. But it's not as if the division dies because Mariah May leaves. You look at Tony, you look at Mercedes, they've got Willow Nightingale, they've got Chris Statlander, they've got Jamie Hayter, Mina Shirakawa just signed full-time, Megan Bain is there, they just debuted Tekla from Stardom, and they have a whole bunch of other women as well. So, you know, they'll be fine. But as far as Mariah goes, you know, everywhere Mariah has worked so far, she has excelled. I don't see that being any different in WWE. She can work, she can talk, she's got sex appeal, she's got everything you would look for in a star. And if WWE is calling up a bunch of names from NXT, Julia's up, Roxanne is up, Stephanie's up, Jordan Grace is likely coming up, that's going to leave a void in that NXT women's division, and that void would be filled very nicely by Mariah May. Mariah May should be your next NXT women's champion. Bring her in, put the title on her, let her run with it for at least 6 months. They're already calling up so many women, it doesn't feel like the right time to throw her into the mix along with them. She deserves to have the spotlight on her for a while. It's the same thing they did with Stephanie. And Stephanie going to NXT was the best thing she could have done. Let Mariah have her run, let the WWE audience get to know who she is, and then when the time is right, let her get the spotlight all to herself when you call her up to Raw or SmackDown. That's the way to go. Now, Stephanie Vaquer has already been announced for a Money in the Bank qualifying match tomorrow night against Liv Morgan and Ivy Nile. Stephanie's a dynamo. I mean, she's been main roster ready from day one. They gave her the option of where she wanted to start, and initially she was going to bypass NXT. But it was her decision. She changed her mind, and it worked out really well for her. So she's a huge addition to that Raw roster. Jordan Grace will be a big addition to the SmackDown side. Julia is already there. She's teasing a U.S. title match against Zelina Vega soon, which Julia should absolutely win. And Ricky Saints also looks to be main roster bound, as evidenced by him dropping the North American title and not even being included in the four-way for the title at Worlds Collide. I mean, Javon Evans is in there, but not Ricky Saints, the former champion. So he's as good as gone. I think SmackDown could use him more. It's also the longer of the two shows, so they need more bodies than Raw does. It's the three-hour show. And didn't you hear? SmackDown is staying 3 hours for the foreseeable future. So saith WrestleVotes. That's a change from their previous plan, which was to move the show back to 2 hours in June. It's been 5 months of this. I said it on my SmackDown stream last week because we hadn't heard anything new about that June 6th date that Meltzer mentioned in The Observer a while back. You know, he said that was the rumored date that they would scale the show back. And then weeks and weeks went by and nothing was said. And I'm like, you know, it's been awfully quiet. I wonder if they're still backing down to 2 hours or if they changed their minds. And I'm like, watch, they're going to end up keeping this fucking thing at 3 hours because USA Network loves it. Right? That's what I said. And plans clearly did change because Triple H himself was on Pat McAfee's show earlier in the year flat out saying the 3 hour format on Fridays was only temporary and the plan was to go back to 2 hours. That was Triple H himself saying that. I'm sure he would much rather write a two-hour show than a three-hour show anyway. That's why Raw is 2.5 hours on Netflix. If he wanted it to be three, I don't think Netflix would object to a three-hour Raw. But there is no wrestling show. I don't care what promotion, there is no wrestling show that needs to be 3 hours on a weekly basis. None. Not a single one. You could dig up Macho Man Randy Savage, and you could throw Bret Hart in a time machine and make him 30 years younger. No wrestling show needs to be 3 hours every single week, let alone these SmackDown shows that they've been giving us this year. Now, WrestleVotes did also say that the show could go back to 2 hours, possibly sometime in the fall. Sure. I'm not falling for that again. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. USA Network is keeping that shit 3 hours well into next year and beyond. I would be shocked if it ever goes back to 2 hours. Why would it? That third hour probably does better numbers than anything the network could air in its place. What does USA Network even have anymore? Nothing. They have shit. They have WWE and Law & Order reruns. That's it. And I love Law & Order reruns. But that's it. That's what they have. Here, look. Here's the USA Network schedule for today. Okay, I'm recording this on Sunday, June 1st. As I am sitting here, Law & Order Special Victims Unit is on. Okay, after that, Law & Order SVU. Followed by Law & Order SVU. Law & Order SVU. Law & Order SVU. Dude, I swear to you, it's all day today. Right on into tomorrow and all day Monday. Literally 24 hours of Law & Order SVU. Tuesday, June 3rd, at 3 o'clock in the morning, finally, Dateline. But fear not, because at 9 a.m., Law & Order SVU is back on. They should give Marishka and Ice-T partial ownership in the fucking network at this point. You really think they're going to give up that sweet extra hour of live SmackDown? It was their idea for Raw to move to 3 hours, and now they went and did the one thing I was hoping they wouldn't do. They did the same damn thing to SmackDown. Fuck USA.
Hey, it's CVV, Chris Famfleet, popping into this episode of Solo Monster Sounds Off to invite you, when this episode is done, to check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Famfleet. Not only do I interview people like John Cena, The Undertaker, Cody Rhodes, Chelsea Green, AJ Styles, Joe Hendry, just to name a few, but I also give my thoughts on everything that happened this week in wrestling. Like, what the heck is going on with WrestleMania 42 being canceled in New Orleans? Where will it be held instead? Go check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Famfleet, on Spotify or Apple or wherever you happen to be listening to this one right now.
Let's go back to NXT here for a second. WWE announced last week that they would be running not one, not two, but three events over the course of AEW All In weekend, with the next Saturday night's main event taking place the night of All In, Saturday, July 12th. From the State Farm Arena in Atlanta, Georgia. They're also hosting the All Women's Evolution show in the same arena the next night, Sunday, July 13th. But they said NXT would be hosting the Great American Bash as well that weekend, without telling us the when and where. And I told you guys last week, gee, I wonder. Saturday night is occupied. Sunday night is occupied. Gee, I wonder when the Great American Bash is going to air. And we got our answer this week. To what should be the surprise of absolutely no one, the Great American Bash will be taking place on Saturday, July 12th, with a listed start time of 2:30 p.m. Eastern for ticket holders, which likely means a televised start time of 3 p.m. Eastern. 3 p.m. just so happens to be the start time for All In Texas. So AEW's biggest show of the year will be running directly opposite the Great American Bash, just as NXT Battleground aired head-to-head with a Double or Nothing last Sunday. And look, there is not a single person who is going to watch that all-in show that now is saying, oh shit, I have to watch the Great American Bash now. Right? Not a single human being. There may be some NXT fans that would watch all-in just because it's going to be a bigger show. But for the majority of NXT fans, it's the same thing. They're not going to watch AEW, they're going to watch NXT. So it doesn't really change much, but WWE has completely dropped whatever veil may have existed before for what they're doing here. Like, the mask is off. They want everybody to know exactly what they're doing. They take glee in it, which is just fucking with AEW for the sake of fucking with AEW. You know, the counter programming generally goes one way. You don't hear about Tony Khan counter programming WWE typically. Usually it's just one way. And they do it not because they have to do it, but because they can. But that wasn't even the last of it that we heard this week. This has yet to be confirmed by WWE, but WrestleVotes reported on Thursday that WWE will be airing an episode of NXT from the former ECW Arena, now the 2300 Arena in Philadelphia, on Tuesday, August 19th. This would be their second time in the venue. Remember, they ran a show last November. Ironically, it was head-to-head with AEW Dynamite because WWE was trying to avoid running that Tuesday because that was the election. I actually covered NXT that night over AEW. What a mistake that was. But what's interesting about this show taking place on August 19th is that it's only 8 days before AEW begins a residency there. In that very same venue, starting August 27th through September 11th. I'm sure that's just a coincidence, though. Yeah, I really didn't think the comments that Tony Khan made about Nick Khan all those years ago would still be bothering him so much. But he seems to have taken it personally. It seems to be a personal thing, because this is Nick Khan. This is Nick. This isn't Triple H. This isn't Endeavor. This is all Nick Khan. This all goes back to him. Now, for Tony's part, he was asked about all the counter programming before Double or Nothing, and this is before some of this latest news even came out. And this is what Tony Khan said. It's pretty consistent. I would say it's the most consistent event head-to-head scheduling that I've seen since Jim Crockett Promotions. I can tell you, this will go a lot differently than that did. And he said that with a smile on his face. You know what I think? I think deep down, he loves this shit. I think they all do. I think they all get off on this. Hopefully it motivates both companies and we get some great wrestling shows out of it, no matter how petty it may be. WWE is holding two PLEs this coming Saturday in Los Angeles. First is their joint show with AAA, Worlds Collide, from the Kia Forum at 3 p.m. Eastern, which will be airing live on YouTube in both English and Spanish. I assume they'll be using a traditional four-sided ring for the show and not the hexagon ring. This is the first AAA show with WWE talent on it since the acquisition, which is still not official, by the way. That is not expected to close or become official until the third quarter, probably sometime in the fall. But once it is, WWE will own 51% of the company. There's only four matches so far. I would think there would be at least one more added this week. But let me run through these matches here with some predictions. We have Ethan Page defending his newly won NXT North American Championship against Javon Evans, Rey Fénix, and Laredo Kid in a fatal four-way match. Ethan Page just won the title. Why take it away from him? Ethan Page is going to retain here. We have Legado del Fantasma, Santos Escobar, Angel, and Birdo taking on El Hijo de Dr. Wagner Jr., Pagano, and Psycho Clown. Angel and Birdo, by the way, will be competing for the AAA tag team titles at Triple Mania in 2 weeks. I still think they lose here. I'm going with the AAA guys for the win. Stephanie Vaquer teams up with Lola Vice to take on AAA's Dalis and Chick Tormenta. Going with Stephanie and Lola for the win. And Chad Gable. Look at Gable, finally in the main event, challenging El Hijo del Vikingo for the AAA Mega Championship. The brand new AAA Mega Champion. On Raw Monday night, WWE listed this match as a match for the AAA Mega Championship. The only problem is, neither of these men were the AAA Mega Champion at the time. Alberto El Patron was the AAA Mega Champion, and he was scheduled to defend that title against Vikingo at the AAA show last night, which he did. And to the surprise of no one, Vikingo beat him to win the championship. So WWE spoiled its own match result. But only in the United States. On Netflix in Mexico, they used a different graphic without any mention of it being a title match. But you see, there's this thing called social media that people use. Plus, it was covered in three of the biggest sports publications in Mexico, so the fans knew. The fans knew they fucked up. They shot an angle during the week on a morning talk show in Mexico with Alberto attacking Vikingo's father as a way to promote the match. It's been pretty clear since WrestleMania. I mean, from the day they made the announcement about the acquisition and Vikingo was front and center, that they were going to build around him as their top star. Even though apparently the last several months in AAA, he had really been phased down. And actually, Alberto beat him a few months ago and had moved on from him. And so all of a sudden, it's like right back to Vikingo. And maybe that would account for the kind of reaction he got, because I saw the video of the end of their match last night, and there were some boos. Like, there were some noticeable, audible boos from the crowd there when Vikingo won the championship. So I don't know if that's just a matter of people realize that he's kind of the hand chosen one by WWE, and they feel like, well, they're going to be shoving him down our throats. Or the fact that, again, he had been phased down and was all of a sudden thrust back into the mega title scene, and maybe they're just not buying into it. I don't know, but Alberto wasn't even there when they initially made the announcement, because, again, they want nothing to do with him right now. It was pretty clear that even though he was the champion, he wasn't going to be for very long. Now, down the road, who knows? Could I see WWE and TKO doing business with Alberto at some point? Yeah, I can, but right now they're not doing that. You know, Vikingo is their guy. He's got the mega title back, and he's not dropping it to Chad Gable. So that'll be a win for Vikingo. Then it's 7 Eastern over at the Intuit Dome. It's Money in the Bank, which apparently Triple H is not a fan of. WrestleVotes Radio reports that Triple H is, quote, not a big fan of the Money in the Bank prop as a whole. And Sean Ross Sapp pointed out on Twitter that Triple H never held the Money in the Bank briefcase in his career. He never took part in any of the Money in the Bank ladder matches, and he was never cashed in on by a Money in the Bank winner. Look, I don't think there's any grand conspiracy here. You mean to tell me that the man who tore both his quads has no desire to climb and get knocked off ladders? I'm shocked. Color me shocked. The man has had a whopping 3 ladder matches in his entire career, one of which was actually one of the best matches of his career. But that's it. 3 since 1998. He doesn't do the ladder stuff. That's it. That's all it comes down to. He doesn't do the ladder stuff. Now, as far as him not liking it as a prop, I'm in agreement with him on that. I have said this in the past when people ask me in the mailbag, how would you change up Money in the Bank if at all? How would you freshen it up, or what would you do differently? What I would do differently, in a perfect world, there would not even be a Money in the Bank pay-per-view. It would revert back to a WrestleMania gimmick, and it would work well now, too, because Mania is 2 nights. You would have the women's ladder match on one night, you could have the men's ladder match on the other night, and that's it. But it's not as simple as just getting rid of the pay-per-view, because Money in the Bank is one of their signature shows now of the year. They sell a lot of tickets. They make a lot of money. There's a big Money in the Bank show they did in London a couple of years ago. Right? New Orleans lost WrestleMania next year. They're getting Money in the Bank as a make-good instead. Now, they got rid of the TLC pay-per-view, and they got rid of the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, but you also then have shows like Money in the Bank and Elimination Chamber that do really well, and they have major storyline implications. So I get why they've kept it. I'm just saying, in a perfect world where business was of no concern, which, of course, is not realistic because it's the wrestling business, but in a perfect world, there wouldn't even be a Money in the Bank standalone show anymore. I'm surprised he doesn't like it, honestly, because it's such a cheat code for a booker to have in their back pocket whenever you want. You could just have somebody cash in and switch the title for whatever reason. But like Worlds Collide, right now they have 4 matches on the card. We have the women's Money in the Bank ladder match with Rhea Ripley, Alexa Bliss, Roxanne Perez, Julia, Naomi, who qualified with a win over Jade Cargill and Nia Jax on Friday. And the winner of the match on Raw tomorrow night between Stephanie Vaquer, Liv Morgan, and Ivy Nile. Now, I figured this to be a win for Stephanie. I think she should win. It's her first match, officially her first match on Raw. But then I remembered she's already in a Worlds Collide match that afternoon. And, I mean, I suppose it wouldn't be impossible for her to work both shows. They're both in L.A. But that makes a Liv Morgan win, I think, a lot more likely. And actually, with Roxanne having already qualified, and them teasing tension between Liv and Roxanne, I think that makes a Liv Morgan win tomorrow even more likely. As far as who wins the Money in the Bank match, to me it almost doesn't even matter if Stephanie gets in or if Liv gets in. I think it goes to Naomi. And I think that Naomi as a heel running around with the briefcase, you know, teasing cashing in is probably what we're looking at here. I think it's what her character could really use right now is something like this. And so as I look at these spots, and again, we still don't know officially who's going to fill that final spot, but I almost don't even think it matters. I think Naomi is going to win this. Now we have Lyra Valkyria defending the Women's Intercontinental Championship against Becky Lynch with the stipulations that if Becky loses, she cannot challenge Lyra for the title again. But if Becky wins, Lyra must raise her arm in victory. Now I was surprised when Becky did not win the championship at Backlash, and now here we are, we have a rematch, the title's on the line. I'm going to go with Becky Lynch this time again because I do think we're going to get a title change. The one wild card here is Bayley. You know, when do we see Bayley back on TV? Do we see her at Money in the Bank? Do they save her post-win for Becky and have her on Raw that Monday? Or even have her come out when the match is over? Because Bayley's on her way back very soon, and she's obviously going after Becky Lynch. The only question is, does she cost Becky, or does she then challenge Becky for the championship after the fact? I think that's more likely, that we get Becky and Bayley for the Intercontinental title. So I'm going with Becky to win the championship here. We have the men's Money in the Bank ladder match with Seth Rollins, LA Knight, Solo Sikoa, Penta, who qualified in one of the best 10-minute TV matches you will ever see, over Chad Gable and Dragon Lee on Monday. What a great fucking match. Andrade is in, and there's one more qualifying match on Raw tomorrow night. It's going to involve CM Punk, AJ Styles, and El Grande Americano. This is probably the closest that you're going to get, by the way. If you want a CM Punk, AJ Styles match, you better enjoy it. Now, unless they shoot some kind of angle to take AJ out of the match on Raw, and maybe somebody like Karrion Kross slides in. There's a lot of very upset people that Karrion Kross was not involved in this. I think it's crazy to not involve him in one of the qualifying matches. But as of this moment, he's not involved. And unless they shoot some kind of angle, which is always possible, I suppose, but unless they do that, he ain't going to be in it. So Punk, AJ, and El Grande Americano. Now, Chad Gable is already wrestling Vikingo in the main event on Worlds Collide that afternoon. So El Grande is there to take the loss, most likely. And when was the last time that AJ won anything big? Actually, you know what? I can't even say that. I can't even say for sure that El Grande is going to take the loss here. It could very well be Styles. They are not above beating AJ Styles. But whoever is the one to take the losing fall, Punk is going to win this. CM Punk is the only correct choice, especially with Seth Rollins already being in Money in the Bank. And I actually thought about picking CM Punk to win the entire thing. It would be his third time winning Money in the Bank. The only reason I was seriously considering going with CM Punk here to win Money in the Bank is because then he could call his shot in advance to cash in against John Cena for the WWE Championship, either at Saturday night's main event or at SummerSlam. We got to get Cena and Punk at least one time before Cena goes back babyface. There's a very small window. Every week that goes by, that window gets smaller. Cena's on SmackDown, though, and the WWE title is on SmackDown. CM Punk is on Raw. So him using the briefcase would solve that issue. How do you get to Cena Punk for the title? Well, he calls his shot and says, I'm cashing in my Money in the Bank, and I'm not cashing it in on Jey Uso. I'm cashing it in on you, John Cena. So I was thinking about that, but I think Punk and Rollins, they take each other out of the mix. And I'm going with LA Knight to win the briefcase. LA Knight was fingertips away from it. What was it, 2 years ago? Before Damian Priest chokeslammed him off the ladder. He has maintained his popularity somehow, some way. He has maintained his popularity with the audience. But he just really feels like he's at a crossroads in his career right now. He lost the U.S. title at WrestleMania. He lost at Backlash in the four-way. He is nowhere near the mix, you know, in the mix for the top title on SmackDown. He desperately needs a move to Monday Night Raw. Him eventually cashing in for the World Heavyweight title would take care of that issue. And I think he could use that briefcase a hell of a lot more than CM Punk can, or even Seth Rollins. Just because Seth Rollins doesn't win Money in the Bank doesn't mean he ain't going to be the next one to take that championship from Jey Uso. right? He doesn't need the briefcase to do that. LA Knight needs this win. He needs this win more than any of the others that you would consider to be the favorites in this match. Penta is not winning Money in the Bank. Solo Sikoa, could he win Money in the Bank? You know what? There's an outside shot. He's got a better chance than Penta, put it that way. But no, Solo Sikoa is not going to win Money in the Bank. Andrade is not going to win Money in the Bank. So realistically, it comes down to Seth Rollins, CM Punk, and LA Knight. LA Knight should be the guy. I don't know if Triple H sees it the same way, but he should. If he doesn't, he should. And then we have Cody Rhodes and Jey Uso teaming up to take on the team of John Cena and Logan Paul. Now, why Cody Rhodes came back at Saturday night's main event? We had not seen him since WrestleMania. He came back at Saturday night's main event last weekend, and instead of challenging John Cena to a rematch for the WWE Championship, he challenged him to a tag team match. Okay. Whatever. I'm just glad we don't have Travis Scott anywhere to be seen in the equation here. Now watch him show up at Money in the Bank. But what they're doing here, as I see it, what they're doing here is they're trying to make absolutely certain that John Cena gets booed when he comes out because they're pairing him up with one of the most, if not the most, hated man in WWE, in Logan Paul, who gets mega heat, and making absolutely sure that Cody Rhodes, who was starting to get some mixed reactions and some boos, you know, not a ton, but enough of them that it was noticeable in the lead up to WrestleMania, making absolutely sure that by pairing up Cena and Logan Paul, that Cody and Jay, who doesn't have that same issue, but making sure Cody gets as positive a reaction as he possibly can. And he did on Friday when he came out on SmackDown. So I really don't think it's going to be an issue. But I do think that was part of the logic here in pairing Cena up with Logan, who's just this hated villain on the show. And they even gave us a little tease in that closing segment on Friday night of some tension, because John Cena wanted to walk away when Cody and Jay were ready to throw down. And he went, you know, he turned to go walk away. And Logan, you know, he stopped him forcefully. And they had a very brief stare down and then they all started brawling. So is that something that we might see in this match? Might we see a breakdown between these two in the tag team match? I'm going with Cody Rhodes and Jey Uso to win. And I do think that we're going to get Cody and Cena. You know what? It could very well be in Atlanta, Saturday night's main event. It could very well be on that show. You know, Atlanta's Rhodes country. Maybe they have a bigger match. I can't even say bigger, but a different match in mind for SummerSlam. Hopefully it's not some other throwaway tag team match for Cena. But whether it's Saturday night's main event or SummerSlam, Cody's going to get his rematch soon enough. And so I think he and Jay should win here. And as of this moment, that's the Money in the Bank card. So we still have the go-home shows this week on Monday and Friday. Very, very likely they will add one more to make it five matches, which is usually what Triple H likes to do on these shows. But that's the card as it stands right now. And as it stands right now, I will not be live on Saturday night on YouTube after the show because I will be working House of Glory that night. So the plan is to get home and catch up with Money in the Bank at that point, and then have a full review on Sound Off 916 next Sunday. And as far as Worlds Collide, same thing. I mean, I'm going to try to, I don't know when I'm going to watch it, if I'm going to be able to watch it before the Sound Off next week. I'm going to try to watch both, and then I'll give my thoughts on the show next week. That's just how it's going to have to be. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Imagine you go to the mall with your kids, but you've got to use the restroom, right? We've all been there before. You got to use the bathroom. So you go searching for it, but you grab the first person who walks by and you ask them, "Can you watch my kids for me? I got to go take a leak," right? You would never, ever do that. At least I hope you would never do that. Now, sure, that person likely won't turn out to be an axe murderer, but we've all heard of stranger danger, right? You wouldn't ever leave your kids in the hands of someone you don't know or trust. That would be the equivalent of going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you connect to an unencrypted network, which could be almost any public network outside your home, any hacker on that same network can gain access to and steal your personal data. That includes your passwords, that includes your credit card details, that includes your bank logins. Even a teenager could do it. It doesn't take a lot of know-how to make your life a living hell. And your data is valuable. Hackers can make up to $1,000 per person selling your personal info on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. Now, what I love about ExpressVPN is that it's fast and it's easy to use. And it works on all my devices, not only my laptop, but my phone and my tablet, which I take everywhere with me when I'm on the road. They even offer an optional dedicated IP service engineered with innovative zero-knowledge design, meaning not even ExpressVPN can trace an IP address back to you. There's a reason ExpressVPN is rated number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. I've been traveling quite a bit for House of Glory this year, and I'll be headed to Texas next month. And you can bet your ass I'll be keeping the ExpressVPN app open on my phone while I'm away from home. As my personal data is mine, it's not intended to be seen by anybody else. That's how it's supposed to be. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Last Sunday, AEW held its Double or Nothing pay-per-view, which was a very good show overall. Anarchy in the Arena, in my opinion, was the best one that they've done yet. It was just a ton of fun, especially once the Drowning Pool song kicked in. You hear Let the Bodies Hit the Floor, and then it was just mass chaos from that point on. Although I could have done without them looping the song 5 or 6 times. But that was great. It led into Dynamite on Wednesday. And we had appearances from both winners of the Owen Hart Foundation tournaments. And actually, the show opened with the winner of the men's tournament, the man who was going on to Texas at All In to challenge Jon Moxley for the AEW World Championship, Hangman Adam Page. He and Ospreay had an outstanding match at Double or Nothing. Could have gone either way. Could have plugged either of these guys into that main event on July 12th, and it would have worked just fine. I like Hangman going to Texas. I like Hangman winning, God, I hope, winning the championship. I know there was a report out this week about Hangman and Ospreay privately behind the scenes were lobbying for the other to win the match. They were so selfless about this. Hangman wanted Ospreay to win and thought he should win. And Ospreay said, no, Hangman should win. And then, of course, people joke about maybe they had a sense that Moxley's going to retain in Texas, and they didn't want to do the job. They didn't want to do the job in the big title match at All In. So no, why don't you win the Owen Hart tournament? And you know what? It may well work out that way. But do I think that was what was factoring into their mind? No, I don't. And you know, some people made a big deal about this in a negative way. Oh, this, you know, it never used to be like this in the wrestling business. And you got to really want it. I look at it a little differently. Like I just laugh when I see people taking a story like this and turning it into a negative thing. Because you know damn well that if the role was reversed and we had stories leaking out about drama behind the scenes and guys lobbying to win and or guys who didn't want to do a job, right? Oh my God, the negative stories that would be out there about AEW and Tony Khan, be a boss, get your shit together, put your foot down. So I just find it hilarious, personally. I like it. I mean, I find it, you know, kind of refreshing in a way that you had two guys here who do feel like they fly the flag of AEW, and they're two of the biggest stars in the company, and they're looking at the big picture here and saying, you know what? Looking at the bigger picture and looking at the storylines and everything, I think that this guy should be the one to go on to, you know, be in the main event, or this guy should go on to be the one to beat Moxley and win the championship. Because I would hope that, you know, assuming this is all true, I would hope that they're looking at the bigger picture beyond just their own self-interest and saying, legitimately, I think that this would be better to go in this direction. This would be better for the storyline. This would be better for the company. You know, I'll still be here. I'll get my shot at some point. Again, I can't get in their heads. I don't know what they were thinking, but I know that that became kind of a big story this week. Eddie Kingston posted something online. He was very upset that this even leaked. He kind of made it sound like he knew who the person was who leaked the story, and then he admitted, I really don't know who it was. I was just very upset. So it must be legitimate, but again, I don't look at it as a negative in the way that some people might. You really couldn't go wrong with either of these guys being in that spot, but Hangman got it. And then they did this segment to open Dynamite on Wednesday where Swerve Strickland came out to confront Hangman and things got tense. And then Will Ospreay came out, and Will Ospreay was in the role of trying to play peacemaker. And he was trying to explain to both these men, look, we got to get on the same page here. We get one shot at this. You know, he's looking up at the All In Texas banner. We get one shot at this to take down Jon Moxley and take down the Death Riders. And it ended without any resolution. Swerve wants nothing to do with Hangman. Hangman wants nothing to do with Swerve. And, you know, Ospreay was left in this position where he's going to have to try to find some way to get these guys on the same page heading into Texas, because the Death Riders, you know, they have strength in numbers and they're allied with the Bucks. And we need all the AEW guys to sort of band together. I thought it was an excellent segment, an excellent start to the show. I'm digging the story that they're telling there. They closed the show. They basically bookended the shows, or the show, I should say, with the Owen winners. And they left the women for the closing segment. So we had Mercedes Moné, who beat Jamie Hayter at Double or Nothing. No real surprise there. She came out for her first official face-to-face with the AEW Women's World Champion and her opponent in Texas, Timeless Toni Storm. Now, this segment was not nearly as good as the opening segment. It was fine. You know, it was a fine introduction between the two of them. And, you know, from that day on Wednesday, they said there were 45 days left to go between Wednesday and All In. And I just hope that whatever they find to do with these two women between now and then is compelling enough to keep my interest, because we have been in this position before where they've had a lot of time, especially with Mercedes. They've had a lot of time between shows, and it can be a struggle to find interesting things for her to do with her opponent when there's a lot of time between pay-per-views. Now, these are two of the biggest names in the entire company. Toni Storm, legitimately, right now, is one of the top names, male or female, in the entire company. Just the way that she is booked and positioned, like her segments, many times will close the shows even more than Mercedes. So she clearly is, you know, a valued member of that roster. And Mercedes is undefeated in her AEW run so far. She's like 27-0, I think, at this point. By the time she gets to Texas, she may be 37-0. Who knows, right? Probably not that many matches between now and then. But it's a big match, and people are clearly into the idea of these two having a match. I'm not saying it's not a big match. I just wish they would have gone a different way with it and saved this match for later on and did something different for Texas. But they wanted to go with the biggest possible match they could, and their segment did the biggest numbers on the show on Wednesday. Over 700,000 viewers on TBS, not counting whatever their viewership is on Max. That was easily the peak of the show. Even their segment on YouTube, when they posted the video on their YouTube channel, it's done over 400,000 views, which is more than anything else that they posted from the show on Wednesday. I think the opening segment with the men did over 300,000. And that was a better segment. But there's definite interest there with Toni and Mercedes. People see it as a big match. I just kind of look at it and wonder if it's a no-win situation, you know, because Mercedes is undefeated. If you have Toni Storm be the one who's already the biggest star in the division, if you have her be the one to end that streak and hand Mercedes her first loss, and her TBS title is not even on the line, I just think that's incredibly stupid. I think when Mercedes finally loses, she should lose the TBS championship. It should be this big dramatic moment. And right now, this is only a one-way street. Only Toni's title is on the line. Now, if Mercedes wins, that only feeds into the narrative that, well, she wins all of her matches and she beats Toni Storm and she wins the championship. Well, now she has two titles. Yeah, the TBS title at least could be something where the other women who were not in the mix for the world title, they have something to fight for. And it feels to me like right now, those women on the roster have nothing to fight for, because these two titles are all locked up by these two women, and coming out of Texas, if Mercedes wins, she's going to have both belts. Now, sure, they can strip her of the TBS title and crown a new champion, but what a lame fucking way to go about doing that. So she never even gets beat. They just take the... She's so dominant, we're just going to take the title away from her. I think that would be incredibly stupid. but you would almost have to. You would have no other choice. Because what are you going to do? You're going to have her go around defending both belts? And then when she finally loses, she loses the lesser of the two titles, but still has the world. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So, big match? Sure. Short-term success? Absolutely. I would even say there's a chance Tony Khan may close the show with the two of them. If John Moxley is not losing the championship. Because if John Moxley is going to lose that championship in Texas, then that absolutely has to close the show. You've got to have him losing, have a big celebration, have the fucking roster come out. If he's not losing, I think there's a chance that Tony and Mercedes could close the show. All of that is true, but I just see it as a no-win situation. Maybe there's something that I'm not seeing here that when it plays out, it'll all make sense to me. But right now, I don't see it. Now, we also had the debut of Tekla from Stardom, the Toxic Spider. I almost wrote Toxic Avenger here in my notes, which I would like to see the Toxic Avenger in AEW. That would be a very interesting gimmick. But no, the Toxic Spider, maybe he could be Jon Moxley. Forget Hangman. Forget Hangman and Darby and Ospreay. Let's have the Toxic Avenger be the one to take the championship from Jon Moxley. I could get behind that. Tekla debuted on Wednesday. She attacked Jamie Hayter. The camera missed the initial attack, which I'm still stunned by that. So then Jamie got back up, and then she got knocked down again. And then Tekla did her little spider pose, crab walk deal. And then they quickly moved along to the next thing. So she is going to be engaged in a feud, or at least have a match soon with Jamie Hayter. What that means for Jamie's future, that's very murky right now. Are they going to have Jamie beat Tekla in their first match? I probably wouldn't be doing that. But I don't know. I don't know how hard Tony Khan is going to push Tekla. I don't know if he's going to push her in the way that he pushed Megan Bain. I haven't even seen enough of Tekla to know whether or not she warrants being pushed that strongly. But she's the new girl, and you, in theory, would want to keep her as strong as you possibly can. So anyway, that's what Jamie Hayter is going to be involved with going forward. The other thing I wanted to just talk about from this show on Wednesday was the TNT title match. They announced this very late in the day. It was just kind of thrown out there. Adam Cole defending the TNT championship. And think about, when was the last time the TNT title was even defended on Dynamite? It's basically become a collision belt. But he defended that title against Kyle Fletcher. And very early in their match, Kyle Fletcher did an apron powerbomb spot to Adam Cole outside the ring that was so reckless and stupid and unnecessary that I was just stunned watching it, that it was even agreed upon. And Cole was okay, and he wrestled the rest of the match and showed no signs of distress, but this was no ordinary apron powerbomb. Just the way he landed and everything, it was nasty. But what upset me about it, just watching it as a fan, is knowing the injury history, the concussion history that Adam Cole has. Adam Cole's career was almost ended by a bad concussion, and he's had more than one. But that concussion that he suffered was debilitating and just really, really bad. Okay, in just very specific terms, it was very, very bad. And he was out for a very, very long time. And so I'm watching a match like this, and I'm just thinking to myself, you know, why would they even do this spot? Especially when it wasn't even, you know, it didn't come at a significant time in the match. It meant nothing. It literally meant nothing. And then Brian Alvarez was on Wrestling Observer Live this week and said that a lot of people within AEW were furious with Kyle Fletcher, partly due to Adam Cole's history of head injuries. He said, I can tell you today, I'm sure I'll hear about this all afternoon, but there were a lot of people furious at Kyle Fletcher, because at the end of the day, whatever you want to do is whatever you guys agree to do. But Adam Cole has had a history of head injuries. He's had concussions. He's had concussions and head injuries we know about, and he's had some that have not been public. There have been other times where Adam Cole hasn't been on television because he had a head injury and it just never came out. So, like, you have to be careful, not just with Adam Cole, but with anybody's head. There were a lot of people very unhappy with Fletcher because what was this dude thinking? I don't have an answer. You know, it's bad enough that they did the spot at all. But again, to do it 3 minutes into the match as just another spot is even dumber. It's not even like it was the finish and they called the match off and they were doing an injury angle. It meant nothing. It meant nothing. Why even take the risk with somebody who has a history of head injuries? Just completely stupid and unnecessary. Now, this Wednesday is Fyter Fest from Denver. It is a four-hour block of AEW programming. It's technically Dynamite from 8 to 10 and then Collision from 10 to midnight because they wanted to avoid Collision airing next Saturday against Money in the Bank and a UFC pay-per-view. So TBS is trying something different. They're going to air the shows back-to-back as a four-hour block, and now I see that AEW is not even advertising it as Dynamite and then Collision. They're just advertising it as one big Fyter Fest show. So here's the current card as it stands. Kenny Omega defends the International Championship at a four-way against Máscara Dorada of CMLL, Claudio Castagnoli, and Brody King. I mean, come on. I mean, does anybody see this as being anything other than a Kenny Omega win? I can't imagine they want Omega to drop that title before the match with Okada. You know, unless they just have no plans of, you know, merging the two titles, which I think they absolutely should do at All In. It should be title for title. Then I guess it wouldn't matter. But why the hell would you beat Kenny Omega before All In? John Moxley against Mark Briscoe. That'll be a non-title match. FTR takes on CMLL's Atlantis Jr. and Templario. Tony Storm and Mina Shirakawa team up to take on Sky Blue and Julia Hart with Mercedes Moné on commentary. La Facción Ingobernable, Rush, Dralístico, and the Beast Mortos take on Commander Kevin Knight. Hey, Kevin Knight, he's back from the Best of the Super Juniors. And Speedball Mike Bailey. Tekla will make her in-ring debut, and the Hurt Syndicate with MJF, who is now part of the Hurt Syndicate, they will be there as well. So that is the lineup for Fyter Fest as it stands. You know, as far as what I'm doing, look, I'm planning on going live after 10 p.m., you know, by 10:30-ish. I don't want to sit through 4 hours of AEW and then just go live after midnight. So I don't know how Tony Khan is going to format this show. It is entirely possible that he will save the international four-way match for the end of the show. And, you know, look, I'll figure out what I'm going to do, but I really don't want to do that. So we'll see. I think they're doing the same thing next week. They haven't announced anything yet, but I think next Wednesday, the 11th, I think it is their summer blockbuster show. And I think that's also 4 hours. So this is not just a 1 week thing. Other news and notes. I did a review recently for the Billy Jack Haynes episode of Dark Side of the Ring, and I talked about him being locked up right now, awaiting trial on a second-degree murder charge in the death of his wife last year. A judge ruled a few weeks ago that Haynes is mentally unfit to stand trial. His trial was set to start in December, and so now everything is up in the air. But in the meantime, per the Fox affiliate in Portland, the estate of Jeanette Bancroft, which was his wife, has filed an elder abuse lawsuit against Billy Jack Haynes, accusing him of 5 years of repeated mental, physical, and financial abuse towards Bancroft in the years leading up to her death. Bancroft was 85 years old when she died and was said to be suffering from dementia. The lawsuit is seeking $750,000 in damages and was filed on behalf of Bancroft's daughter, Kimberly, through her attorney. Among the claims filed against Haynes are that the former Portland wrestling star made Bancroft cut off contact with her family, liquidate her retirement funds and withdraw money from her account, and abandon her medical providers in favor of doctors that he had a historical relationship with. This comes courtesy of KPTV News in Portland. The suit also claims that Haynes introduced her to drugs, including heroin and meth, forced her to purchase a gun for him that he was unable to acquire due to his criminal record, and that he coerced her into marrying him in 2021. Among the other claims are that Haynes prevented food deliveries from Bancroft's family from reaching her, and that he had Bancroft change her estate planning so that her family would not receive any of the proceeds. Sounds pretty shitty to me. Even if they win, though, they'll never see a dime of that money. I mean, the whole story is just depressing. Eric Bischoff, on a recent episode of his 83 Weeks podcast, was talking about Bill Goldberg's upcoming retirement match, which is rumored for Atlanta on Saturday night's main event next month. He talked about how instrumental Hulk Hogan was in elevating Goldberg in WCW, and he believes that Hogan should be present for Goldberg's final match. And for him not to be, it would be incomplete for Goldberg's story. I guess he wants Hogan there so that Goldberg can finish his story. He said it was Atlanta. It was Hulk Hogan that said, I want to get Bill Goldberg over as much as I can, and volunteered to do business with Bill in Atlanta. That wasn't my idea. That wasn't Bill's idea. That wasn't Ted Turner's idea. That was Hulk Hogan's idea, because he believed that much in Bill Goldberg. To not have Hulk there for a match like this would be, I don't know, an incomplete story. I don't think Hogan needs to be anywhere near this, because then the story shifts from Goldberg's retirement to Hogan got booed again. And honestly, that's not fair to Goldberg. But I can't deny what Hogan did for Goldberg that night was huge for him. I mean, whatever you think his ulterior motives may have been, I'm sure Hogan didn't just do it out of the goodness of his heart. But that night, he did the clean job, right? None of that kick out at 3.1 nonsense that he pulled before with people like the Warrior, or the bullshit with Sting at Starrcade. That's an example of how to fuck up an entire storyline and do things the wrong way. This was an example of how to do things the right way. You know, he did for Goldberg that night what Andre did for him. Now, should they have done it on pay-per-view instead of free TV? Probably. But they got destroyed in the ratings the week before, and Bischoff just lived and died by the ratings. I mean, his entire podcast is named for the 83 weeks they beat Raw in the ratings. It's his entire existence. Plus, they had pay-per-view matches that were already planned with Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone and the Jay Leno crap they did in August. I'm sure that was all worked out well in advance. So, you know, maybe they felt like they couldn't move those matches, and so it was now or never. Like, I don't know. But they had 40,000 people in the Georgia Dome that night. Or actually, it was 41,000. They claimed 39 on TV. I've never seen a promotion do that before, by the way. I've seen plenty of promotions, and WWE has made an Olympic sport out of this, of over-exaggerating their attendance or over-inflating their numbers. So if they did 50,000, they'll call it 60,000, right? You've heard of promotions do that before. I've never heard of a promotion that actually undersold what their legitimate attendance was. But I remember Tony Schiavone, we got 39,000 people here in the Georgia Dome. They had a lot of people there. And it is the greatest moment in Nitro history. Nitro had a lot of great moments. That was the biggest and greatest moment in Nitro history. You could say that Scott Hall showing up was maybe the most significant. That's fair. But it just in terms of moments, this is it. It's Hogan, Goldberg in the Georgia Dome and Goldberg getting him up for the jackhammer. And then just look at that crowd reaction when the referee counts three. It was the peak of Goldberg's career. You know, he's about to wrestle his retirement match in 2025, but the absolute peak of that man's wrestling career was July 6th, 1998. And Hogan, you know, for all the things we could say about Hulk Hogan and the kind of person he is, no one worked the big spectacle match better than Hogan. Hogan Andre, Hogan Warrior, Hogan Goldberg, Hogan Rock. Some of the most legendary matches of all time. Nobody can take that away from him. But this isn't about Hogan. It's about Goldberg. Keep him the fuck away. And speaking of legends that should be kept the fuck away, legends that have disgraced themselves in recent years, sad tweet this week was a slam dunk. And it goes to Ric Flair. You know, people were joking online that he might have been hitting the bottle a little too hard yesterday. No, he's just an asshole and showing himself for what he really is. No need to make excuses for the guy. First, he tweeted out a photo of a mock sexual consent contract that he called the Woo Compromise, which is actually not new. It's something he sold signed copies of on his website in 2018 for $50 a pop as a Valentine's Day gimmick, before WWE asked him to take it down, so it wasn't up for very long. All of a sudden yesterday, it resurfaced. And it lays out the terms for mutual consent in sexual encounters with the Nature Boy. It said, by signing this compromise, both parties involved agree to ride Space Mountain and engage in sexual relations on this night. So I'm just wondering, like, are those two separate things then? Like, the way it's written here, it almost reads like two separate things. Do you actually get to ride the real Space Mountain and then have sex with Ric Flair? I don't know. It says, this contract adheres to guidelines of informed consent, and both people in the relationship must be present and not in an intoxicated state before signing. No party should be pressured or persuaded into something they do not want to do, and they reserve the right to terminate the contract if need be. This contract has the signed and sealed approval of the Nature Boy Ric Flair, who has taken many women for a ride on Space Mountain and has the utmost respect for women. Oh yeah, I'm sure he does. Says the guy who used to helicopter his dick around at women and has been divorced 4 times. I guess this was his attempt at humor, although I'm not sure why he decided to post this now after so many years, but whatever. That would have been one thing if that was the only thing he tweeted. But right after that, it might have even been within an hour of each other, he posts this, tagging Jim Ross, who just this week had surgery for colon cancer. Jim Ross will always be Jim Ross, seeking attention. Focus on your recovery, at JRSBBQ. Ric Flair calling out Jim Ross for seeking attention, calling out anybody for seeking attention. Now that's rich. That's rich. That's so rich, Flair hit it up for money so that he could pay back the IRS. That's how rich it is. What an absolutely shameful thing to say to somebody who just had cancer surgery this week. And for what? That he didn't say. But the Podcast Heat channel on YouTube just released a video clip from a longer show. I guess you would call it show. It was JR and Tony Schiavone. They were riding down the road in the car. JR was sitting in the passenger seat telling a story with Schiavone behind the wheel. This isn't recent. I don't believe it's that recent. It may have been from a year or two ago. I don't remember exactly when this was recorded, but it's not like it was recorded 2 weeks ago. But what they're probably doing is cutting up clips from a larger video and then releasing them in pieces. And in this clip, JR told a story, which I absolutely believe is real, about once going to a birthday party for Gary Juster's wife. Gary Juster was a promoter and an executive for Jim Crockett Promotions. He worked for WCW. He's worked for Ring of Honor, even MLW. Right? Gary Juster has been around forever. And it was a small gathering, and again, birthday party for his wife, who was this very homely school teacher, apparently. And there were only a few wrestlers there. Flair was one of them. Kevin Sullivan was there. His wife at the time, Nancy, the future Nancy Benoit, JR. So Flair shows up with his garment bag. This is after a show that night. He heads right to the bathroom. He comes out of the bathroom and he's wearing his robe, a shirt, shoes, knee-high socks, and no pants and no underwear. But he's got a giant boner. And he begins strutting around the restaurant. Totally normal behavior. But we've heard a million stories like this about Flair over the years. This was just JR chilling in the car with Schiavone and the cameras rolling, and he's telling stories. That's all this was. It's not like we haven't heard stories about Flair like this before. I mean, it's not like he recorded the fucking thing last week either. Flair, though, must have gotten wind of it now, and he decided, you know what, now would be a hell of a time to call JR an attention whore and to basically mind your own business. Of course, neither of the two tweets are up anymore. He deleted them both. And then he posted this. He said, if you can't take a joke from a 76-year-old man, then you are living life too seriously. It was all harmless, lighthearted fun, just trying to make people laugh and smile. I'm assuming that's in reference to the mock contract. That still doesn't explain the JR tweet. There's nothing funny about that. And no, he wasn't drunk. And no, he wasn't hacked. He's just an asshole. And he wins the award for sad tweet. On a positive note, though, the surgery that JR had this week was to remove cancer from 2 different areas, and he said the surgery was a success, and now the rehab begins. He didn't say anything about having to undergo chemo or radiation. It's always possible. The doctors want to make absolutely sure that any trace of cancer is gone. But that's all he said, so that's all we know. All the best to JR. He has said that he hopes to return soon to AEW. He would like to be in Arlington for All In Texas. That would be nice, you know, to hear him on the call for at least one match on that show. He's the greatest to ever do it. You know, Dave Meltzer said this week that going forward, the Best Announcer Award in the Observer Awards will be renamed the Jim Ross Award, since he won the damn thing 14 times. I think that's very appropriate. When Dark Side of the Ring released its episode listing for season 6, and I saw Daphne's name included on there, you know, we know her as Daphne. Her real name is Shannon Spruill. When I saw that, I knew this was going to be the heaviest episode of the entire season, and the most depressing, because her story is a really sad one. You know, here's a woman who still had so much to offer, who felt it was necessary to take her own life at just 46 years old, even though she had plenty of friends and family members who would be the first to tell you what a kind, generous person she was, the kind of person that you would want to be around and have in your life. That someone like that could do what she did is very depressing. This was only a year after Hana Kimura took her life, and that was a big story at the time. And so here we are again with somebody who felt like there was no other option but for them to do what they ended up doing. And if you're someone who's contemplated suicide before, or you know somebody who has taken their own life, and I'll bet some of you do, unfortunately, this may not be the best episode for you, but I do think it's important to tell her story and for them to let people know who Daphne was, because there are people who may not know. And what she went through, not only with her bipolar disorder, but her injuries and the way that she was treated, especially during her time in TNA, people should know. And I wasn't sure how this was going to come off, but I thought the producers handled her story very respectfully, even ending it on a positive note, as positive a note as you can end an episode like this on. It's still obviously a very sad story, but really showing at the very end the kind of person that she was. I thought it was very powerful stuff. They interviewed Daphne's father and brother for this, as well as several of her friends and co-workers from wrestling, Crowbar, Devin Storm from WCW. Jamie Lynn Senegal and Daphne, they were not related by blood, but Senegal refers to Daphne as her mom because Daphne mentored her and claimed her as basically her adopted daughter not long before she passed away. Senegal tweeted that she refused to take part in the episode and she refused to watch it. I guess because she was worried how Daphne might be portrayed in it. Daphne was portrayed fine, so she had nothing to worry about as far as that goes. How Daphne got into wrestling was she wanted to be an actress, and she had done a few movies. She was a child actress, and her agent asked her if she wanted to audition for the role of David Flair's stalker in WCW. And all she was told was, just go out there and act crazy. And so she did. She did such a good job that it turned into a recurring role, and it led to her making wrestling her full-time career. This is what she wanted to do. Crowbar said Daphne stood out because of her goth look at a time when a lot of the other women on TV looked like Barbie dolls. I wasn't watching much of WCW by the time she came in. That was during the Russo era there, but I was aware of the stuff that she was doing with David Flair. I know she even had, what was it, like a two-week run as cruiserweight champion. One of the few matches Miss Elizabeth ever wrestled in her career came against Daphne in WCW. It wasn't very long. It only lasted 30 or 40 seconds, but that's something of a trivia note because Liz did not wrestle a whole lot in her career. But Daphne had that piercing scream. My God, this woman could break glass with that scream. That's why they called her the Scream Queen. You know, the character and the scream, it was based off the character Juliette Lewis played in the movie Natural Born Killers. And she's also cited the Harley Quinn character as an inspiration for it. A month before WCW closed its doors and got sold to WWE, they cut her. And she wanted to stay in wrestling, so she trained at the school that Dusty Rhodes was running at the time for his Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling promotion. And then in 2003... she was offered a developmental deal by WWE, and she got sent to OVW, and she was managing a young Aaron Stevens, who would later go on to become Damian Sandow. So she was signed in July. By December, they released her. And at that point, she was going to go back to acting, and she even sold her boots to Mickey James, who she was rooming with at the time. After that is where things started to take a turn. She had a 3-month period where she couldn't sleep for more than an hour a night. She developed a stutter. She called her father and told him, look, something's wrong. And her dad said that's when she first started thinking things would be better if maybe she just wasn't around anymore. So that's also when she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is characterized by extreme mood swings where you can go from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows and just become depressed. Now, everyone goes through mood swings in their life. I mean, that's not what this is. This is a lot more severe. It's a lot more intense. And it can lead to people having suicidal thoughts. Her best friend Amanda was interviewed. She's also a wrestler, and she also suffers from bipolar. And she says there are drugs that you can take, but the side effects are horrible. But Daphne couldn't stay away from wrestling. She worked indies for a long time, including Shimmer. We heard from her ex-boyfriend, Caleb Conley, who's been wrestling for probably 20 years now. They dated for 4 years, and they met when they were in the business, but her bipolar disorder was always front and center in their relationship. So things would be great 1 minute, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, her mood would change, and she would have a short fuse. So ultimately, it led to the end of their relationship, but you could hear the pain in his voice and how much he cared about her. Obviously, they stayed friendly, but you know, they spent 4 years together, and it was just clear it was not going to work out. Fast forward to 2008, and she gets a shot with TNA Wrestling. Now, she had made a few appearances for TNA in the past years ago, but she was paired up with Shark Boy at one point. She was Shark Girl. So she did some stuff like that, but it was in 2008 when she really got her shot as the governor, which was a parody of Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin was the governor of Alaska at the time. She was John McCain's running mate in the presidential election. The woman was a walking meme machine. She was a gold mine for comedians. My God. And they wanted her to play Sarah Palin on TV. Like, this is fucking Saturday Night Live or something. And so she did. And she did such a good job, a lot of people had no idea that Daphne was the one playing her. So after that, she was back to being Daphne, because that was always going to have a short shelf life, and the election was over. And so she ends up working with Stevie Richards. And then we get Mick Foley here in the episode. Mick was a part of this. He said that he loved Daphne. A lot of people love Daphne. But on commentary, I remember they would refer to her as being zombie hot. That was one of her... I don't know if it was a nickname, but it was like a tagline. She's zombie hot. She even had a shirt in her pro wrestling tee store that said zombie hot. She just had this girl next door vibe going on. Like if the girl next door was goth and had tattoos all over her body. Her segments on Impact, you know, the quarter hour ratings were consistently far higher than they had any right to be given the level of push that she was getting. I mean, it wasn't like she was pushed as a top star. And the thought was, again, girl next door type vibe. Maybe she was someone who was attainable in the eyes of the fans in a way that all the Barbie doll looking girls were not. All the ones who look like America's Next Top Model. But Daphne, I mean, this is a girl that I could get with, right? That's sort of the idea that goes through people's heads, even though, you know, I'm sure the answer is no. But she had a certain appeal that kept people tuned into her segments. And they consistently did very well. People loved Daphne. But Foley loved her so much, he wanted her to be part of a story they were doing at the time with himself and the Monster Abyss. Foley and Abyss, they were scheduled to have a Monsters Ball match at Bound for Glory. This was in 2009. And he said Daphne was always up for anything and she was ready to do whatever was asked of her. What he didn't know was that the Monsters Ball match would be the beginning of the end for Daphne. This is the part of the story that makes me very angry. And this goes all the way back to the early days of the Sound Off in a segment that I did on TNA's treatment or mistreatment, as it were, of the Knockouts. Daphne being one of them. Now, times have changed And TNA has changed and it's under totally different management now. But women's wrestling now is far more prominent than it was back then, at least in this country. Even though the Knockouts were really leading the charge, you know, WWE wasn't doing jack shit with their women compared to what TNA was doing with the Knockouts. Gail Kim, Awesome Kong, they were the two who really led the charge with their feud. They had some great matches together, great feud. And Dixie Carter admitted that the Knockouts were consistently doing the highest rated segments on their shows. But then Gail Kim left in 2008. Why would she leave and go back to WWE when they fumbled the ball with her so badly the first time? Because TNA didn't want to pay her. Even though she was one of their biggest stars, when her contract came up for renewal, they offered her something like $35,000 to re-sign with the company. Now you factor in road expenses and she would be making nothing. So she left to go back to WWE for a few years, and that didn't turn out any better for her than her first run did there. Taylor Wilde. Remember Taylor Wilde? She was a former TNA Knockouts champion. She got paid so little, she needed a second job working at a mall at a sunglass hut to make minimum wage. And then one day a customer said to her, "Hey, wait, aren't you the TNA Knockouts champion?" She was the champion at the time. She quit her job right there on the spot that day. It was so embarrassing for her. This is a company that was backed by the Carter family. Dixie's father was bankrolling the entire thing. He worked as an energy executive for Panda Energy. They aired on Spike TV, which was and is one of the bigger cable stations out there. They were hardly some starving indie promotion. And it wasn't just the women. I mean, to be fair, there were plenty of other stories about guys getting hurt in the ring and trying to rehab injuries instead of getting surgery, even when they really needed surgery, because they knew that they would be on the hook for those costs. Hernandez, Sean Hernandez, he had neck surgery, and the company fronted him the money for it, but then they garnished a certain amount of his wages each paycheck after that for a long time because he had to pay them back. Ron Killings, R-Truth, left TNA for that very reason. He got hurt. Not in TNA's ring, but they booked him on the show where he did get hurt, and they took a percentage of whatever he got for the booking. He hurt his knee, he had surgery, and then they wanted him to pay it back in full. There were plenty of stories like that, even going back as far as 2003. Yet they could afford to pay Johnny Fairplay from Survivor $300,000 for 40 minutes worth of work that he gave them when you add up all of his appearances. And I still have no fucking idea what he actually did for them. And they gave him health insurance, too. Meanwhile, they have a world champion working at Sunglass Hut just to be able to pay her bills. But I digress. We come back to Daphne. Daphne had been involved in Monsters Ball matches before that same year, in fact. She beat Taylor Wilde in one at Sacrifice. And then she teamed with Raven in one at Slammiversary. So she was no stranger to these types of matches. But on this night, at Bound for Glory, it was Mick Foley against Abyss. Daphne is on the ropes, and she gets chokeslammed off the ropes by Abyss through a table with barbed wire on top of it that they made into like a bridge from the ring apron to the guardrail. She goes through it, and she smacks her head hard on the floor. And Foley says they did want her to play a role in the match and that she was game to do it. But we also have Daphne's friend Lexi in the episode who says Shannon called her that day and told her, "They want to throw me through this table with thumbtacks and barbed wire and all this stuff." And she said Shannon told her, "I don't know if I feel comfortable doing this." But of course she did it because she wanted to be a team player. But if she felt uncomfortable, she should have said something. Maybe she did. Maybe she did and they talked her into doing it. Who knows? We'll never know. The stories at the time were that Terry Taylor and Vince Russo were the ones who pushed her to do it because they felt it was needed for the show. But it's like the Owen Hart thing. Owen's family says he wasn't comfortable going up and doing the Blue Blazer entrance. But he was threatened that if he didn't do it, he would be out of a job. And it's hard for me to believe that they would just fire someone like Owen Hart for not wanting to do a dumb entrance, but maybe they would have. Or maybe he thought they would have. And if he didn't want to lose his job or be in breach of his contract, you know, we told him to do something, he said, "No, you're in breach." then I can see where he would have felt like, you know what? Okay, let's just do it and get it over with. Like, unless you're in that position, you can't really know what someone is thinking in that moment. It's like, oh, well, why don't they just say no? You know what? It's not always that cut and dry. In hindsight, I wish she would have said no, but she didn't. And she suffered a very bad concussion. She had no memory of what happened after. She also broke her arm. We got footage from backstage. I don't know if that was actual footage of the aftermath or if that was some other footage from an angle they used here. I think it was from that night. And you see Daphne in the back. She's in pain, and Foley is with her after they load her into the back of the ambulance. The worst part about the whole thing, aside from Daphne getting hurt, is that she went through all of that, and their cameras missed the fucking shot. You see Abyss chokeslam her off, and you hear the crash, but you don't actually see her take the bump. And Spike wouldn't let them air the spot on Impact because they had a policy at the time of not showing any male-on-female violence. So unless you were in the building, you didn't even see the spot. She had no business being back in the ring as quickly as she was. But a few months later, she was back. And then she got hurt again. And if the table bump wasn't the beginning of the end for her, then this match was. She had a match with a wrestler named Miss Betsy. Or Rosie Lotta Love is the name that she used after TNA signed her. Because see, Lotta Love, because she was a big girl, hence the name. There was a lot to love. Ha ha. So years later, WWE signed her. She lost like 130 pounds. She entered the Mae Young Classic. She was under the name Sage Beckett. She lost to Bianca Belair. And then she was let go 9 months later. Never heard from again. Not even in the business anymore. Rosie came out of the Team 3D Academy. She was trained by Bully Ray and D-Von and was recommended for a tryout by Bubba Ray Dudley. And she proceeded to nearly kill Daphne in what was her tryout match because she was fucking terrible and didn't know what the fuck she was doing. So naturally, TNA signed her to a contract. And I don't even think she lasted a month. She had like two or three matches and they realized how bad she was and they got rid of her. That's two different companies that signed her, only to let her go shortly thereafter. That should tell you everything you need to know about her. But in the match with Daphne, and they showed highlights here of what happened, she sat down on her and crushed Daphne's sternum. She gave her another grade 2 concussion. She gave her a stinger on top of everything else. Evidently, in TNA back then, that qualified you for a job. Now, in the episode, they have footage from a shoot interview that Daphne did in 2013. Talking about filing a workers' compensation claim against TNA as a way to try to prove in a court of law that wrestlers were not independent contractors, they were employees. But they didn't get into a lot of the nuts and bolts of this. What happened is TNA refused to pay for her medical bills after the chokeslam bump at Bound for Glory. She had to go to the emergency room. She racked up bills. They totaled over $26,000. She alleges that TNA made a $600 payment and that was it. When she got hit with a letter requesting payment for the remaining money, she claimed that Terry Taylor, who worked in talent relations at the time for TNA, told her that the company would pay the remainder, only they didn't, which led to even more letters that she needed to pay this money. You got to pay this money. This is your responsibility. And in one of those letters, they cited that TNA had declined to pay the balance because they deemed Shannon an independent contractor. Despite what Terry Taylor had told her, that's why she was contesting the whole independent contractor classification in the first place, because TNA was citing it to the insurance as a way to refuse paying her bills. And in her lawsuit, she also alleged that the company's lawyer in Texas, which is where Panda Energy was based, their parent company, had advised TNA to delay the payment as a way to try to settle it for a smaller amount. Just keep delaying it. Now, Daphne's team claimed to have proof of this through emails that were forwarded by Terry Taylor to Shannon. And her team even had the attorney, the Texas attorney, named as a witness and had him deposed in her case. Now, TNA did eventually, finally, settle the claim for around $8,000. But only after this woman was hounded for over a year by creditors who were demanding that she pay these bills. So she ended up settling the lawsuit before it even went to trial because had the courts ruled in her favor and deemed that she was an employee and not an independent contractor, I mean, it would have been the biggest story in wrestling. it would have sent shockwaves through not only TNA, but the entire industry. You know that WWE was watching that case just as closely as TNA was, because it affected them just as much. And they would have done the same thing. Let's settle this shit as quickly and as quietly as possible, because if we don't, it's going to open up a whole can of worms that we're not going to be able to close. Now, I never knew what the settlement was because it was confidential. She did get some money. How much money, I don't know. But in the episode, Caleb Conley says as part of that settlement, TNA gave her 1,000 of her action figures, which he says is a crock of shit. So, like, here's this woman who had a near-death experience for your company, and the best that you can do, and again, I don't know how much money was exchanged, but the best you can do is, hey, why don't you take this and go make your own money hawking them at indie shows and conventions? Like, that's insane. That is insane to me. But now, at this point, she knows she can't wrestle anymore. It's been taken away from her, and she has to figure out what to do next with her life. She's still a young person at that point, so she did signings and appearances, and she worked with Shine, the promotion down in Florida. She told her family she wanted her brain to be donated to be studied for CTE after her death. She ended up self-medicating. She would mix that with alcohol, and that's not a good combination. And she was in a terrible car accident where her car hydroplaned and flipped upside down in 3 feet of water. So she had neck fusion surgery years later because she was dealing with pain that was just so bad, even with the meds, she just couldn't think straight. But after that car accident, she was sent to rehab. The court ordered her to rehab. The night before she was to have checked into rehab, she thought about suicide. But she made a pact with her friend that if the thought ever crossed her mind, she would call her friend to let her know, and that's what she did. Now, she had issues with her meds. They were causing her to gain weight. She didn't look the same anymore. She would read some of the horrible comments people would make online about her appearance. That didn't help her mental state. Then COVID shut everything down in 2020, and she felt even more isolated, which is something, you know, everybody went through that. It's not anything that's unique just to pro wrestlers. Everybody during the COVID shutdowns went through something similar, where you felt like you were just isolated from friends or family or from the rest of the world. But in the case of someone like Scott Hall, I remember Kevin Nash telling this story, you know, it was even worse for someone like Scott and all of his vices and demons to be isolated away from everybody and stuck at home by himself. And he feels that was part of what did Scott Hall in there at the end. That certainly didn't do him any favors. So it wasn't doing her any favors either. And then we get to September 1st, 2021. I was getting ready to go live on YouTube as soon as Dynamite ended when I saw what was going on. It was the first thing I talked about after I went live because I was still kind of, you know, flustered by what I had just seen. Shannon went live on Instagram, and all of her friends got the notification on their phones, and they were troubled by what they saw. So was I. And she's crying. She had a gun in her hand. She was talking about not wanting to be a burden on her friends, talking about how alone she felt. Do you not understand that I'm all alone? She said the thing with CTE and concussions is that can only really be diagnosed after you're dead. So I don't want to do anything to hurt my brain. I want it to be studied. I want the future generations to know, don't do stupid shit like me. Just remember, my brain goes to Boston, straight to Boston. Boston is where the Concussion Legacy Institute is located. It's run by Chris Nowinski. Her friends all start freaking out. They're trying to get in touch with her. She's not answering her phone. Her friend Lexi logs on, and when she does, Shannon notices and messages her, apologizing and saying she was going to break her promise, which was heartbreaking. That was the promise that if she ever had any thoughts of suicide, she would reach out and let her know. Crowbar tried calling her over and over again, kept getting messages saying her voicemail box was full. Foley tried calling her, nothing. And then the screen went black. Now, from the TMZ article at the time, this is what TMZ reported. Police were called for a welfare check. According to the police report, they were met by Daphne's mom, Jean. They knocked at the door, but there was no answer, so they left without trying to gain entry. They came back a second time a few hours later, and this time they saw Daphne's car parked near the apartment. A maintenance man gave cops a key, but it didn't unlock the deadbolt, so the fire department was called. And they broke open the door, and they found Daphne's body on her bed with a gunshot wound to her chest and a gun within reach. She shot herself in the chest to protect her brain. It's like Dave Durson. He played in the NFL for the Bears. This was years before Daphne. Same thing. He shot himself in the chest because he wanted his brain to be tested. And they found that he had CTE. It's just so incredibly sad that here you have this woman who's saying, I'm all alone. I have nobody. Don't you understand that? At the same time, all of these people are rushing to call her and text her that she's not alone. And she has a lot of people who love her and care about her. I don't know if it was her bipolar. I don't know if it was CTE. Whatever it was, she genuinely felt that she was all alone. And it's just awful. Her family did donate her brain to Boston. They did find evidence of CTE. They didn't say how much. It would have been sad enough to end the episode like that. I'm glad they included the story, though, of her and Vicky Lyons. So Mick Foley said that he was watching an episode one night of Forensic Files. And the episode was about this girl who was run over by a car. And he Googled the girl's name just to see what comes up. And the first thing that came up in his Google search was Vicky Lyons having a wrestling match with Daphne. And Michael Bukikio, the owner of HighSpots.com, has also told this story. He was very close with Daphne. When Vicky Lyons was 4 years old, she was run over by a pickup truck that backed over her while she was playing outside. And she survived, but it left her disabled. She had damage to her skull, one of her eyes. They said she would never be able to lead a normal life. And she has since passed away. She died of a brain aneurysm. I think she was in her mid-30s. But before that, she had taken an interest in becoming a pro wrestler. And she went to wrestling school. She trained for 5 years. And it was during that time that she became friends with Daphne. It was Daphne's goal to let this girl live her dream and have a pro wrestling match. The one and only match that she ever had. And it happened in 2008. So this was even before all the awful stuff that happened to her in TNA. But this is a great example of the kind of human being that Daphne was. They had a match. Daphne put her over. Of course she did. I mean, can you imagine? After all that, they get to the building and Daphne's like, creative control, brother. But she put this girl over and she let her live her dream. And the match is on YouTube still if you want to watch it. But that's who Daphne was. They ended the episode on a high note with that story. It was the most powerful episode they've done all season and still very fresh. I mean, again, it hasn't even been 5 years yet. So it felt a little bit different because you have all these other episodes on the Sheik and Ludwig Borga and Muhammad Hassan and all these different things that were 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago. This all still feels very fresh. And it was just a very sad end for someone who did not deserve to go out the way that she did. And it's a good opportunity here to just let people know who may be listening to this that if you are in a dark place, suicide is never the answer. Because when you make that decision, there is no going back. There is no second chance. You don't respawn. It's not how it works. And there are other people, whether you believe it or not, who do care about you and who do want to help you. So pick up the phone and dial 988. That's the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. They're online as well, but it's just three digits. Just talk to someone. Sometimes that's all it takes. The season finale on Muhammad Hassan, it aired on Tuesday. I did watch it. I'm going to be saving that review for next week. I noticed that the Daphne episode did the highest viewership of all the episodes this season, 140,000. Even more than the Superstar Billy Graham episode did. 140,000 is still low compared to what the show used to do. I think the highest rated episodes are still the ones on Owen Hart and Chris Benoit. But more people tuned into the Daphne episode than any other one this season. Let's take some of your emails. You can send me emails to thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I got an email this week from Mika. I hope I'm saying it right, and it's Mika. Could be Mika. From Tampere, Finland. 1 year ago today, I graduated as a glassblower, and your podcast was something that got me through school. Every Monday, I start my day by listening to your show. Thank you for what you do, and keep up the great work. Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. My question is, do you think the term sports entertainment has done more good or harm to professional wrestling? At least here in Finland, professional wrestling, and he says in Finnish, it's ama, let me see if I can pronounce this right. In Finnish, it is amatele, paini, is referred to, I guess that means, is referred to as show paini, which in English means show wrestling. And actual wrestling, like Greco-Roman, is seen here as real professional wrestling. See, that's interesting. It's interesting how, again, in different parts of the world, it's just viewed or termed differently. As far as your question, has it done more harm than good? I think if you just look at it from a business perspective, it's done far more good. Because it's opened up wrestling in ways that if they would have just kept it, almost like portraying it as straight sport. And something that's always 100%, you know, super serious, then wrestling would not be where it is today. And there are some wrestling traditionalists who may look at that and go, that's a bad thing. I don't see that as a bad thing. I'm not a huge fan of the term sports entertainment. I know why Vince started using it back in the 80s. I do think, though, it opened up the business in ways that it just would not have been opened up if they didn't embrace that as being what it is. And that is what it is. It is a mixture of sports and entertainment. It's a combination of the two. Do I think that he got overly reliant on it as the years went on to the point where it almost seemed neurotic? Yes. Yes, there was a point in time, believe it or not, where he had people working at his PR department when you would have people giving interviews and quotes to news outlets who didn't even want the word wrestling mentioned. Like, you would have to refer to them as, like, entertainments. Thankfully, that didn't last very long. I just remember when the reporter came out and revealed all of this, and I was like, are you shitting me? Like, I did a whole segment about it on the show. Like, hey, Dad, let's go to the entertainments tonight. Nobody in the history of the world has ever said that, and nobody ever would. But that's how, I mean, that's just how anal he got about the whole thing. So, I think, you know, in the big picture, it did more good than harm, although it goes both ways. I just think he took it to a point where it got a little ridiculous, just in terms of how it was labeled publicly. But that's what it is. I mean, it is sports entertainment. That's what it is. Mike from New Boston, New Hampshire. With the announcement of the final Men's Money in the Bank qualifier on Raw, I was thinking, could we see AJ Styles taken out in the back by Karrion Kross for AJ not taking advantage of WrestleMania and having Kross being inserted into the match? During the match, Penta takes care of El Grande, and Rollins' crew takes out Punk with Kross not only pinning Punk, but also qualifying for Money in the Bank. Not only does he get into Money in the Bank, but he also gets a pinfall over one of the biggest stars in the company. What say you? I think that's a great fantasy scenario. I think you could certainly dream about that if you're a Karrion Kross fan. But the idea of him getting into the match would be one thing. I could see them shooting an angle like that to get him in. But the idea of him pinning CM Punk to do it, I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's impossible if Seth Rollins' group were to knock him out or something, but I think you're in dreamland, Mike, if you think that that's actually going to happen. Kenneth from Carlsbad, California, by way of Nashville, Tennessee. What if Hangman Page loses at All In, and it leads to Hangman versus Swerve versus Ospreay, where Ospreay wins and faces Moxley at Wembley, and that's who beats him? I only say this because the way things have been playing out, it makes more sense to have Hangman lose by getting screwed by the Bucks because Hangman has turned babyface now. This would lead to Hangman and Swerve against the Bucks at Wembley, and then you have Ospreay against Moxley. And with the Bucks taken out, by their match, you have the ops to deal with the Death Riders. Well, AEW is not returning to Wembley until next year, so if you're waiting for Wembley, that means another year of Jon Moxley as the AEW World Champion. And Kenneth, I know some people have masochistic tendencies. I'm not one of those people. Now, if you mean Forbidden Door, because Forbidden Door is in London at the O2 Arena, Will Ospreay winning the title there, look, it would be a big moment. But if Hangman doesn't beat Moxley in Texas, the only reason is because they're saving it for Darby Allin. They're not saving it for Will Ospreay. The Bucks costing Hangman and giving him a reason to put his differences aside to tag with Swerve, like that absolutely would make sense. And maybe that'll happen. And we get that tag match in London. But if Hangman does not win the championship, it is because Darby is getting it. And I think that would be a mistake. Hangman as champion is an infinitely better choice than Darby Allin. And I hope he wins it. Chiamo from Johannesburg, South Africa. Been listening since King of the Ring last year. Where do you rank Bianca Belair and Rhea Ripley all time in WWE? I have them top 10 already, he says. Top 10. Yes, I would agree. Rhea and Bianca would be in my top 10 as well. I'm not going to rank them because, I mean, you put me on the spot here. I'm not going to rank them. I don't know where in the top 10 they would rank yet, you know, and they're still active. But I can tell you that number one on that list has to be Becky Lynch of all-time women's wrestlers in WWE. When I say that she was a top star in that company, like, I don't just mean top star in the women's division. Like, at one time, she was the big thing in WWE. She was an attraction. She got to rub shoulders in some form or fashion with all the big names. It could have just been a fist bump or something, but I mean, she did it with Stone Cold and The Rock and John Cena. Like, first women's main event at WrestleMania. Plenty of great matches in addition to all of her other accomplishments. She had great matches with Charlotte Flair, Sasha Banks, Trish Stratus, Asuka, Bianca. Becky's got to be number one. Sasha's up there too. But Rhea and Bianca are definitely in the top 10. Obviously, Charlotte is in there as well. The rest is a little fuzzier to me. You know, Trish is in there. Trish is not number one. I said I had Becky at number one. Trish is on the list. But the rest of it is, it gets fuzzy. Isaiah from Norfolk, Virginia. My question ties into some comments you made on your Dynamite review this week about how you do not really care for what Paragon is doing on the show. I wholeheartedly agree with you because Cole, O'Reilly, and Strong have lost all momentum since the later years of their WWE run and early AEW tenure. Although there are good things going on in AEW, they are not one of them and are just kind of guys that are there. It feels like a watered-down version of Undisputed Era because Adam Cole has lost all of his aura. And personally, I enjoyed O'Reilly and Fish as the tag team, but Bobby isn't there. Where's the lie? Isaiah's not wrong. He's not there. The injuries and the horrible devil storyline really hurt them. At this point, I'm just ready for Ricochet or Kyle Fletcher to win the TNT belt from Cole because I just don't feel anything for him at the moment. I get your point about Adam Cole. Again, aura is not a word I would use to describe Adam Cole. That's a word that should be used for a select few. But yes, Adam Cole does not have the same, what would be a good word that's not aura to you? I've tried to think of a replacement word here. He just doesn't have the same flair, you know, that he had at one time. You know, and again, at one time, he was going to win the AEW World Championship had he not gotten hurt. So everything went to hell when he suffered that ankle injury. And I'm just glad that he's back. He's healthy enough to be back in the ring. I'm happy for him. He seems like one of the nicest guys in the entire business. He really, and I've never met him before, but just any interview or he does Twitch streams or whenever people talk about it, like he just comes across as the nicest guy and you want to see him do well. You want to see him succeed. A lot of people make a lot of very nasty comments about him and him being small and having no muscles and all this other. He's too small. I can't buy into him in a top spot. Right? People say all kinds of things about Adam Cole. But the reality is right now, he is at a level or two below where he used to be. I don't mean in the ring. I'm just saying as far as Adam Cole and where he is in the pecking order there. I don't know if he'll ever be back up that high again. At this moment, there are enough people in the top mix where I don't really consider Adam Cole to, you know, be a candidate to be in the top mix because they have enough people there as it is, and I just don't see him in that spot. Right now, he's in a good spot for himself. He's the TNT champion, but yeah, I mean, all three members of Paragon just feel like they're there. You know, I don't get excited when Paragon's going to be on TV. I'm like, okay, whatever. Who cares? So I'm with you, brother. I mean, that's why I made the comment the other night. I wasn't saying it to be a dick. It's just how I feel. And maybe that'll change at some point, but that's not the case right now. Kyle Fletcher, you mentioned Ricochet. Kyle Fletcher is the one who should be taking the TNT championship from Adam Cole. I don't know if they want to hold off on that for Texas. I mean, that's still 5 or 6 weeks away. It could be on one of these big dynamites in the next few weeks. I don't really give a shit, but Kyle Fletcher should be the one to get that championship just based on the way that they have pushed him. They've really created a star in him. It's him and Takeshita in the Callis family. You know, Takeshita had his run as the international champion. I think Fletcher should get a run of his own. And with that championship, that's the one that would make the most sense to me. But yeah, Paragon is, I still don't even know why they changed the name. I'm not saying Undisputed Kingdom was much better, but like, why even bother changing the name when they had already been established under the other one? That's also still very weird to me. Josh from London, England. I remember briefly DX and the Nation having beef. I remember seeing a locker room incident, but can't seem to find anything more on YouTube following the full feud. How did that all begin, and how did you find that feud at the time? I think it may have stemmed from, now I want to say it was King of the Ring. It might have stemmed from the King of the Ring tournament that year. I know Rock beat Triple H early in the tournament. He bounced him out of there, so he wasn't going to be able to win King of the Ring 2 years in a row. And I think from there, the two groups just started feuding. Maybe there was a match that predated King of the Ring, I'm not remembering, but I just remember Rock eliminated Triple H on TV, and after that, they were feuding. Triple H had also been feuding with Owen Hart, if you remember, earlier that year, and then they ended up both turning. I mean, they didn't do a double turn like with the two of them. There was a double turn. So a few months later, Triple H is the babyface with DX, and Owen is the heel again, and now he's with the Nation. So maybe there was a tie-in there as well, but it transitioned pretty quickly to Rock and Triple H, and I enjoyed it. At the time, I enjoyed it. I thought it was very entertaining. Rock and Triple H, they went on to have that classic ladder match at SummerSlam. Owen Hart beat the crap out of Jason Sensation when he was doing all those impressions of him. It was good times. Actually, the night that Owen beat the shit out of Jason Sensation, that was the very first Raw that I ever attended. I was up in one of the luxury boxes. And I remember Owen came running out because they had Jason Sensation on commentary and Lawler just kept egging him on. He loved all the impressions. Yeah, he was doing impressions for Brett and Sean and he'd do one for Owen. And then he's like, give us another one. Like Lawler's just egging him on. And Jason Sensation, who was just a fan, I don't even know how he got involved with them, but he's having a blast and Owen is in the back with the Nation. He's hearing all this and he doesn't find any of this funny. So he ran down to the ring. He starts beating the shit out of him. Yeah. Yeah. I was in the building for that night. Daniel from Hamburg. I listened to an older Ric Flair shoot back and Rick mentioned not liking how Randy Savage was preparing his match with Steamboat at WrestleMania 3 beforehand. Whose in ring work did you like more, Savage or Flair? Well, what he's referring to is a famous story that Savage pre-planned and wrote out every single spot in that match. I don't know how many of them there were, 60 or 70 spots. And I think he wrote them down on like a yellow legal pad and for weeks before the match, like he would quiz Steamboat at random. He would like shout out a number of a spot, like 17, and Steamboat would have to recite the spot back to him. That's just, I don't know that Savage did that for every single match he ever wrestled, but for that match and probably some other ones, but for that one, I know he did. He wanted to go out there and have the match of his life. And they did. It's still a match that's talked about to this day. Some people think it's the greatest match in WWE history, but I'm not aware. I don't know that Savage did that for every match. As far as whose style I like more, Savage. You know, Flair had great matches. Flair's had legendary matches that I love. But as a as an in-ring performer, the way I look at it is this. Savage, when he was a heel, how would his matches go? How would he bump around? What things would he do in his matches as compared to Flair? Savage was just more of a dynamic performer than Flair was. You know, Flair in many ways was kind of vanilla. Vanilla is not a word I would use to describe Randy Savage. If that makes sense. So as far as their in-ring style and in-ring work, I go Savage over Flair. Tay from DC. Rank these wrestlers 1 through 5 based on who you think was the best coming out of a tag team. Shawn Michaels, JBL, Jeff Hardy, Batista, and Edge. He says, to clarify, when Batista transitioned to Evolution out of the Reverend Devon stuff, he and Ric Flair were a tag team, and they were a successful one, holding the belts at one point. Yeah, I guess that's true, but I don't really see Batista as a tag team guy. You know, every other person that you have on this list, like, they were truly like a tag team wrestler. I don't really think it's fair to lump Batista into that category. He was part of a team, but I never really looked at him as a tag team wrestler. I'll rank the other ones, though. Shawn Michaels, number one, easily. Edge, I would have at number two. Jeff Hardy, and then JBL, in that order. And Dylan from Taiwan. What is your favorite wrestler with a second job gimmick from the early 90s, and why is it Repo Man? Boy, you read my mind. You know why? Because when it comes to the Repo Man, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine too. You know, Barry Darso and Bill Eadie, they did an interview recently, and they talked about their new Legends contract that they signed with WWE. They think it's for something like 6 years. But it's going to allow them to have, you know, action figures. I think Edie said, like, DVDs. People are like, what's that? They're going to put our music out on cassette. they're going to release a Best of Demolition compilation on those VHS tapes. We're going to get a cut of those. Oh, I love them. But I think in talking about it, it was either Edie or Darso mentioned that the Repo Man is part of this. So there may be Repo Man action figures. Dude, we may get Repo Man in the fucking video game next year. So you won't have to create him anymore. You can have an authentic Repo Man that you can play as in 2K26. How great would that be? Anyway, thank you, Dylan, and thank you, everyone. Whether you are in Finland or Taiwan or right here in New York, I hear from people all over the world every single week. It never gets old. I appreciate all of you. I appreciate all the support as well. I hope you will tune in next week when I am back with episode 916 next Sunday of the Sound Off, where at this moment, it looks like that will be the Money in the Bank review, plus whatever other news there is to talk about, and the final Dark Side of the Ring review, which I hope to be working on this week for the season finale, the Muhammad Hassan episode. So there'll be a lot of content coming your way next weekend. Of course, this week I'll be live on YouTube on Monday, on Wednesday, on Friday, live on JD's channel for episode, 98? Are we up to 98 already of Tuesday Night Titans? That's coming up on Tuesday. And then next Saturday, I will be at the NYC Arena doing commentary for House of Glory. Mike Santana presents Puerto Rican Weekend for the second year in a row. It was a hot show last year with a hot crowd. Hopefully we'll have more of the same next weekend. He'll be defending his championship on that show. Again, tickets are still available. Maybe I'll see some of you guys there. So a very busy week coming up. When is it not busy? It's always busy. We had breaking news here during the show as I was recording. So be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week as we kick off the month of June. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Swerve begins to walk down the hallway, and all of a sudden, who bursts through the doors off in the background. Hangman Adam Page comes charging in. He says Swerve is wasting his time because he made a promise long time ago that Swerve Strickland would never hold the AEW World Championship ever again. He's not going to let this go. This man is still obsessed. Hangman screams that you broke into my house. Swerve screams back at him, you burned my house down. So Hangman screamed, you deserved it. And then Swerve, you're right, I deserved it. God, I fucking love pro wrestling. Like, it's just so fucking absurd. But I love it. How can you not love this shit?
The Solo Monster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solo Monster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solo Monster.
I love you so long.